Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the fifth session of the Expanded Budget Committee. And let me, a couple things at the beginning. I want to remind the legislators that of the process of amending. If they want to make amendments to the budget, you would email them to Kevin, and he will begin to collect those from you. Obviously, we have one more listening meeting on Thursday, but our first voting meeting comes on October 6th. But in between that time, we have a budget forum on the 5th. We have a ledge meeting on Tuesday. So I'm giving you the opportunity to think about these things if you have amendments, you know, pluses and minuses you want to make to the budget as far as you know it. The second thing, Kevin, also on your desk, there's a very large piece of paper that looks like this. It is the information that you asked for from Human Services Coalition last week when they were here. So that is there for your use and perusal. Joe has one thing he wants to say, and then we will immediately head to the rural library budget.
Yeah, Carol had asked a couple of meetings ago for my crib sheets, the color-coded OTR list where we line out each of the OTRs and kind of status of each. So if that is of interest to you, I'll have them right here. If you want it during the course of this meeting, I can go ahead and pass them out right now. I will remind you that these are my own notes, so they don't have the precision that you would expect to see in the budget document itself. So if it's off by a few pennies, it's on me.
For those department heads who are in the room, we have a schedule that we're trying to keep with, and I would appreciate it very much if you knew your time schedule and it fit into what we were trying to do. And, you know, I am not about to shut anyone off as a department head, but we've had some meetings recently that have turned into more meetings than I felt like they should have turned into. And I wasn't certain that we were getting, we were going where we needed to go sometimes. And not the fault of the department heads, by the way. So I'm ready, and I think we're all ready for the rural library services. So you are on.
I am on.
Please use the microphone. If you have people around you want to introduce, also do that.
Okay. Well, thank you for letting us come. We're the rural libraries in Tompkins County. My name is Diane Pamel, and I'm the library director at Southworth Library in Dryden. And if my colleagues could just pop up here, introduce yourself, or there, pop up there, or just come here, okay?
Thank you. My name is Tammy Kubinek. I am the director at the Newfield Public Library.
Susie Gutenberger. I'm the director of the Lansing Library.
Annette Birdsall, director of the Trumansburg Library.
And I am Sarah Glagowski. I'm the executive director of the Finger Lakes Library System.
And Sarah Knoble is the director at Groton and is unable to be here tonight because she's ill. So thank you so much for your support over the years. We appreciate your interest, your input, and your income. We want to emphasize we've been around since most of us since the 1800s, mid to late 1800s, and have served our communities in a unique way. Most of our services are not duplicated anywhere else within our neighborhoods or communities, and are sought after. We serve patrons of every ethnicity, socioeconomic level, ability. Whoever comes in the door, they're our patrons. According to a 2016 Pew Internet Research Survey, 2/3 of all adults and 84% of emerging adults feel the library has a major impact on our communities. each of our rural libraries also uniquely serve the communities in which they exist. We're leaders in innovation, in programs, and in events. The Ulysses Philomathic Library, which Annette can address later in more detail, recently led the way in sustainability with new solar panels that they installed at their library. Even if you as individuals do not have a library card, we'd be happy to get you an application. Or use your local library. The value of libraries to our communities goes beyond the typical services you may think of with the buildings that you've seen. Our libraries are so much more than books. We bring not only collections and resources to our communities, but support literate, productive, and informed citizens. Some of our libraries were summer lunch sites, which no one else could provide in Groton anyways. We have yoga, Spanish classes, mahjong, writing groups, Girls Who Code clubs for those in rural areas that don't have it available in their high schools, and a number of different things. In a nutshell, what we provide, libraries are community builders, collaborators, centers for education, champions for youth, centers for technology, and digital resources. Libraries provide programs for all ages and are often catalysts for community conversations. In rural areas, we've had Martin Luther King celebrations and brought in discussions about race for communities that maybe aren't facing it on a daily basis. We bring value to our communities and our community gathering space as well. We are collaborators. The library is a center for people of all ages and backgrounds to find fuel to feed their passions. But the center doesn't have to be confined to library walls. We collaborate with other organizations as well. We have outreach to schools, parks, senior centers, local food distribution centers. We share resources and act as a center for local programs and gatherings. And we collaborate with each other, even more importantly, whether sharing information, ideas, or grants. Libraries are centers for lifelong learning, for adult program and discussion groups, community information and support, classes, lectures, centers for cultural and ethnic diversity. We pretty much do it all. We are, as most of you would think of us, as champions for youth. We have our early literacy programs. We do after-school programs, school support, and teen engagement. And one of the things that we provide to our communities, which is so critical in these days, is a safe place, an air-conditioned or heated safe place for people to come. We have a lot of kids that come after school because it is the safe place in their communities. Libraries are also centers for technology. A newer function of libraries, newer as because I'm old enough to say that. We have high-speed internet access and wireless access and state-of-the-art computers, which is always a challenge to keep up. Along with being technology within the library, we also provide digital resources. The invisible digital library has actually hit a market for us that we didn't hit before. A lot of people that don't come in the doors, but that come in our virtual doors and use our library strictly for digital downloads, for digital magazines, and for our newest service, which is streaming video or streaming audio books and e-books. So those three platforms are called Zinio, Hoopla, and Overdrive. And we often spend a lot of time with people on their various devices. There are so many devices in the world right now. And people are even, they're doing everything on their phones. So we get to figure out how to do all that as well as librarians. But we can't do that on our own, as try as we might. If we were isolated libraries, our scope would be very limited. As part of the Finger Lakes Library System, for those of you that aren't aware, we're all connected and Sarah is our ABLE leader at this point in time, it gives us access not only to those digital resources, which we couldn't provide on our own, but to the resources that are available in each of the member libraries, of which there are 33 that go in 5 counties. Interlibrary loan services connect us all. You can read the numbers, 136,000 plus items were transferred in just year to date. Well, that's actually year to August, right?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, through ILL services. And if you had a need for a book that was in Timbuk 5, we can get it for you and get it mailed here. 3,015 items were obtained from libraries outside of our 5-county system and mailed here and brought right to the doorstep on the libraries that people use. Of the rural libraries in Tompkins County, we are one of the most active counties in using interlibrary loans. And that's not TCPL, that's just the rural libraries. So a fifth of them were for our libraries. Within our libraries, as far as materials we loan out to other libraries, 18% of the total was from rural libraries that of items we received, and 15% was what we loaned. So, as I said, we're fairly collaborative in the way we operate. A critical part of the Finger Lakes Library system for us is the technical support we need for computer systems and for web support. The library catalog software that they provide, the online databases, you can call and get connected to a library through the Ask Us 24/7 service for any question you might have. And we will use due diligence to find you the answer. Any new initiatives and programs generally come from Finger Lakes because they have the time and the know-how, and they're keeping their fingers on the pulse of library trends for us. And they provide training and assistance. So, how do we do it? Most of us have support staff of 3 to 5 people working part-time, some full-time, to support all the library functions and programs. Some of them have higher education and are library professionals, and some are just staff that need to do that. So with the recession of 2008, which we all hate to look at, we saw, besides a decrease in employment and income, we saw a significant increase in the use of our libraries and visitors and circulation. And the interesting thing is that level has stayed the same, even though, thank goodness, the economy is not. At the same time that we've seen that steady increase that is now plateauing at our normal, the explosion of digital devices and resources has changed the way that we live and also the way we operate. Tablets, phones, mobile apps have created an entire market for our services and an additional user base. So these users expect the same kind of services and resources that they get at NYPL and New York Public, and regardless of our budget or knowledge base. So we have the challenge of providing that. So for those of you that may be wondering how, because that's been a question, what are our funding sources? The county funding, which we rely on, and thank you so much for. But we also get input, each of us, from our towns and villages. Some of us are school district or school tax ballot funded. Some of us have endowment income or memberships. We all do fund drives, and we all aggressively pursue grants to be able to do what we can do. And this gives you a picture of a few of the libraries. You'll see most of our expenses, a primary part of our expenses, is for our staff. So there's the numbers that we've got, and this reflects a 2% increase to each of the rural libraries for target funding, and we appreciate that. But it also includes a one-time OTR to be dispersed to Finger Lakes Library System for offsetting the cost of the new e-content and services, as you can see. Each year, our costs continue to increase for materials and the cost of keeping our doors open. We also have to look at the costs that have continued to increase for our staffing with Fair Labor Standard Act and New York State minimums. We appreciate that. We've been able to get closer to that through your generous funding last year and are continuing to work for that. So that brings us to the digital platforms that so many of our patrons use. Specifically, I have the percentage in here somewhere, but it's a past slide. It was about 20% of the digital platform, digital downloads are used by our rural libraries. So the cost for that, the Hoopla is the streaming service. That's the new one, which I'll get to. Zinio is the magazines, which I highly recommend if you read magazines at all, you try. And Overdrive is the digital downloads for audiobooks and ebooks. There's licensing fees for Overdrive as well as content. Member libraries are contributing to that, as well as donations from the Friends of Tompkins County Public Library. They're also Friends of Tompkins County, but it was the it was the Friends of the Public Library. The Hoopla platform is a new platform that is digital streaming. And the reason we are asking for a one-time support is that that came on after our current budgets were set. We're still working on meeting the needs that we have that are consistent and that continue to have a high demand, as well as accommodating the digital platforms. So we were asking for a one-time assistance to support that new platform until we can get ourselves on the ball with adjusting our budgets as we need to. So, thank you for helping us continue our community.
Thank you. Anyone have any questions from the ledge? Peter and Carol.
Just a question that occurred to me while I was listening to you. Do rural libraries give school children an opportunity, a quiet place where they can come and work and maybe find things that they're interested in books or not? Is that one of your functions, or does that happen in the schools?
No. Well, after school, the nice thing about the rural libraries is they're open after school's out. So during school, they have library time,
right,
but they can come anytime. And every day we're helping someone.
Do a significant number take advantage of that?
Yes.
No, yes, definitely.
And all of our county libraries in Tompkins County do significant outreach to all of our local schools.
Okay, thank you.
Carol, Martha, and Mike.
So are the, on the over-target request, thanks for coming, are the Zinio, Hoopla, and Overdrive, are they available for both Macs and PCs and Android and whatever else are the big major systems out there?
Yes, and I actually have information about all three. I've brought bookmarks for Zinio, information about Hoopla, which is our newest service. All of them you can use on a smartphone, a tablet. For Hoopla, which does streaming movies, music, it also does ebooks, e-audio, and also what a lot of our patrons are using it for are e-graphic novels and comic books. And those, for instance, Hoopla can even be streamed over a game station or something like that. Currently, it doesn't do Roku, but that's coming. But you can use a tablet, you can use a phone, a regular PC, a Mac, any of those to use any of these platforms.
And are they the same systems? Are they used by...
You download apps.
Does the Finger Lakes Library system, you know, the downtown library, and their member libraries, do they use these same systems?
Yes, all 33 libraries in our system use this.
Great. Thank you.
Martha.
Thank you. Hi, Diane. Could you go back to the slide that's got the cost of the Hoopla about the digital platforms? That one.
Yes.
I'm a little confused here. So you've got 40,000, 40,500 in those three lines, Hoopla, Zinio, and Overdrive. I love these names. I never heard of these things. Is the 16.5 another cost in addition?
Okay, so Overdrive, for example, we just have to pay a fee to bring this service to our libraries, so that's the licensing fee. Then we ask our member libraries to contribute, and we also get donations from the Friends. And this money, the $16,500 and the $30,000, are what we use to buy titles for Overdrive. So specific books, specific e-books, e-audio materials. Okay. Zinio, it costs us $7,500 just to provide the service, but we also buy magazine subscriptions for patrons. So a typical Zinio magazine subscription is higher than a personal magazine subscription. You might be able as a person to, say, get a year's worth of Vanity Fair for $12. We have to pay between $40 and $100 for titles, and these are for multiple users of Zinio. So it's $7,500, plus we do, you know, over $10,000 worth of subscription titles.
Okay, so those are all annual costs. Wait. So it's 21, 7, 12, and 16 are costs, right?
Yes.
30 is the revenue from the Friends. But our OTR is not for that.
We've asked for $7,500 to add content to our e-content, which would be Hoopla, Zinio, and Overdrive. And this $7,500 would buy titles for these platforms. So it would buy, in essence, a book, an ability to stream music, a movie, purchase an audiobook for patrons to download.
So essentially it would add to the $16,500.
Yes, it would.
But you're only asking for it one time.
Correct.
Okay.
Can I speak to that for a minute?
Please use the microphone.
The OTR request is for content, and the member libraries in the rural member libraries have come together to make this request to support Finger Lakes' ability to purchase this because they've set their budget with the platforms and all of their initial costs. But we know our patrons are demanding these titles, and we don't have the budget to give to them. And we're just that's our only answer. Chermansburg supported $500, which we took off of our print collection, but our print collection has not gone down, and that's true for everyone. And in the first month of the launch, TCPL, which you know their size, had 312 uses. Chermansburg had 136. We were the next highest out of all of the 33 member libraries, including larger libraries like Cortland and Auburn. So we're really struggling to meet this need for content that our patrons are demanding. So that's why we're looking for the initial support, and then we're going to have to reassess our budgets and alignments for next year. So I hope that helps clarify.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, it does. And do you all have high-speed wireless internet in the buildings?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. Okay, thanks very much.
Mike Lane.
Having served on the Southwood Library Board, and I always mention that to everyone, and as a trustee, we were there when we actually were the last holdout to not be a library as part of the Finger Lakes Library System, and we came on, and this trustee is very glad we did. I recently read that Cortland Library is talking about withdrawing from Finger Lakes. Is that the case?
No.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I guess the article in the paper was wrong. Okay, I was wondering how it might affect you financially if they did.
Anna.
A few clarification questions.
Anna, please use your microphone.
Yes, absolutely. The vital technology and program support, did you say that it was 24-hour support access? Did I miss that?
Yes, it's called Ask Us 24/7.
So we have two... for the under the Finger Lakes slide, is that what you're asking
yep.
for? So, yes, we do provide two libraries in on-call service. So if the catalog is down, a lot of our libraries, say, are open on Saturday, but we're not. Finger Lakes, the building is not open. But we do provide 24-hour service, and then we can go in and assess the problem and then provide a technical support. So we do provide technical support to the libraries.
For the online systems?
Yes.
And then you contract with a service provider to do support for 24, so like the turnaround is immediate, I'm assuming.
So for Ask Us 24/7, mm-hmm. Ask Us 24/7 is an online reference that we have a consortium price. It's actually through our regional library council, the South Central Regional Library Council, and that is an online service where anyone in our service area can go on and ask a reference question 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and be provided an answer to your reference question by a trained librarian. It might be a librarian in Ithaca. It might be a librarian in New York City. It might be a librarian in Washington State. But you will get an answer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from a trained professional.
That was one of my questions, and thank you so much. That was wonderful. Another one, just curious about what percentage of all of the patrons are the ones that you said were exclusively online? Do you have that estimate of the relative amount of people that are increasing with respect to online exclusively?
I don't know if I have that statistic. Do you guys?
We don't track.
Yeah, we don't track usually that way.
That would just be so interesting to
yeah.
see what that
yeah.
population is.
I can make
so
a note.
Curious.
Okay.
And the last question was with the three software that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Is that... These are the same systems, Hoopla, Zinio, Overdrive, the same systems used in all 33, or is that?
These are used on all 33 libraries of the Finger Lakes Library System. They are all separate companies. Hoopla is a separate company. Zinio is a separate company. Overdrive. Yep.
But all 33 have contracts with all three of them?
Through us, yes.
Through you, and so mm-hmm. those are negotiated as a group rate?
We negotiate the rate.
Yep. For everybody.
Yep.
Okay, and then that is just evenly spread out by percent of patrons weighted, I'm assuming?
Yes. What's going to happen, though, is eventually, just due to cuts in budgets, demand for e-content, we will be asking the libraries in the future to contribute more to this. Our funding from Finger Lakes, 80% comes from the state. As you know, state funding is questionable at times. So unfortunately, the only opportunity we have to increase services is to sometimes ask our member libraries to contribute more.
And have you heard anything from the state, any bird chirping that you may see?
None, and that's very unusual. We had a meeting in mid-August where they usually give us projections and they were silent, which in my mind is not very good news. But at this point, we have not gotten any indication from the state about funding for next year.
Thank you.
Yep.
Good enough. Thank you all very much. Oh, Dooley?
Yeah. I was intrigued that the cost for you to get a Vanity Fair subscription is so much higher.
Yeah, that's...
So is this something that individual residents could gift the library every year of subscriptions instead?
Libraries don't usually tend to do that because they tend to buy all of their magazines at one time, like in January. I know when I worked at the Tompkins County Public Library, we frequently had that request. Patrons wanted to help out. They did do, like TCPL does do a donation system where they take donations and then buy, you know, beginning in January for the year. Typically, all libraries are charged higher for subscriptions. It's just something that...
We historically have had certain individuals, one of them might even be through like a bequest, but they get Birds and Blooms or something like that every year, and they have it sent to us. So we at Southworth, we kind of have a mix between that. Magazines, it's interesting. Aside from People magazine, because everybody wants to know about Brangelina, printed magazines are kind of, unfortunately, I mean, they're so beautiful, so many of them, but they're sort of going the way of I don't know what, things past, and more people are really excited about the digital magazines.
I ask because I subscribe to magazines, and every year, you can buy, renew your own and give one free.
Right.
And it's very tempting to do that. Yeah. And I have done that in the past. So you're saying that's not particularly useful for our local libraries.
I don't know about your libraries. Can you speak to that? Or
We're happy to accept donations, but you do have to realize that all contributions that come to the library require our cataloging and processing of them. So the costs do, you know, it's not nothing to us even to accept those donations. And again, some of the specialty magazines then don't get read. So we only have a certain amount of shelf space, so we're kind of at a premium for assessing that. What we also, and I'm sure this is true for our other member libraries, is we will take them and have a free share. So current titles we take in of catalogs and magazine and have spots for people to just trade with each other. So a lot of our services are more neighborly than library related. So I'm sure the library that you're with would be willing to talk with you about that and how best it would serve them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you so much for listening.
Next is the Office of Human Rights, Karen Barron. Some of her people are here, and we are ready for that.
Jim, excuse me. The libraries are another example where they have their own budgets, but we don't see the full budgets, right? We just see what we do.
Right.
Is that something that... I think we used to see all that, and we don't have a desire to see it anymore. I don't like to keep making requests for each group that comes in that I want to see your whole budget.
Well,
but we don't have a policy at the moment.
No, not that I know of. I think when you've asked for other budgets, when we're one small part, and then there are other bigger budgets or bigger contributors, then obviously, we've tried to give people that information. I don't know in 10 years that I've ever seen, the only budget I've ever seen is our own public library. But, Joe?
Yeah, this is very similar to the Human Services Coalition the other night, where on the program pages, last year we did show a full budget and then how much of that budget we contributed. We did, again, we talked about this last time. We didn't do that for 2017. We'll see what we can get. Kevin, I don't know whether we can either have that information right now or we'll get that information for you. But if that's a good piece of information you like, we will certainly do our best.
Carol?
If this is specifically about the rural libraries,
it's about many things.
Okay, because I just remember a few years ago we spent a lot of time hearing about why each of their situations is unique. For example, the Dryden, the Southworth Library has a large endowment, so they have income, and other libraries don't have any sources of income. So they weren't equal, or they were each unique.
Thank you. Karen, you're on.
Good evening, honorable legislators. I'm Karen Baer. I'm the Director of Human Rights. And to my left is Xavier Rusk. He is the office's paralegal aide. So first I'd like to provide you with a schematic of what we call at OHR the building blocks of our philosophy for promoting and protecting human rights in Tompkins County. You may have seen this before, but it is a foundation for how we think about this work. And the programming that we and the services that we try to provide. As you can see, at the core of protection is the civil rights enforcement. At the core of promotion is the human rights education and outreach. The stepping stones, so to speak, that guide us include collaboration, partnership, and bridge-building strategies. And our desired outcomes look like healing, celebration, and dialogue. And of course, in order to sustain this work, we need community support and a government that is responsive to the voice of the people. So our major goal this year is to engage in a meaningful and public conversation around the issue of restoring local enforcement powers for the Office of Human Rights in order to better serve the citizens of Tompkins County. We'd like to share with you some of the distinct examples of how we've tried to emulate and implement these ideals in the last year and going forward. In terms of education and outreach, 2016 is marked by the 29th annual Human Rights Arts Competition that is currently underway. It is our very popular K through 12 art and poetry competition that attracts over 500 students countywide each year. The program encourages kids to express through their artwork what they find meaningful about the 30 articles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, signed by the UN member nations more than 50 years ago. On December 10th each year, on International Human Rights Day, we celebrate and showcase the winning entries and artists in a recognition ceremony. It's a lot of fun for students, teachers, and families, as well as OHR staff. Partnership. In the fall of 2014, OHR joined forces with the Advocacy Center of Tompkins County, the Cornell Law School Global Gender Justice Clinic, and the Tompkins County Human Rights Commission to bring attention to the issue of domestic violence in our community. This collaboration led to the drafting and promotion of a resolution recognizing freedom from domestic violence as a fundamental human right. By the spring of 2015, and after numerous public engagements, circulated petitions, focus group surveys, interviews, and lobbying efforts, each municipality in Tompkins County, including the county legislature, the city of Ithaca, and the Tompkins County Council of Governments, passed resolutions declaring freedom from domestic violence as a human right. The passing of these resolutions was a very significant achievement, but the work did not end there. And going further and forward, it became our goal to provide a meaningful and practical framework for implementing the ideals expressed in these resolutions. Our new objective was to provide employers, both public and private, the necessary tools for successfully putting those words into action. The result of that continued effort produced a domestic violence and workplace model policy and a private employers toolkit. This important work continues as we plan to create opportunities for training and networking around these materials and this issue. Collaboration. The Tompkins County Office of Human Rights and the Human Rights Commission have joined a statewide coalition effort called the Statewide Source of Income Coalition, coordinated by Erase Racism New York and comprised of dozens of organizations and businesses from across New York State that are supporting an amendment to the New York State Human Rights Law to expand the protected classes to include lawful sources of income, such as wages and salaries, and federal, state, local, corporate, and nonprofit assistance payments or subsidies. In other words, this amendment would extend housing discrimination protections to individuals utilizing housing choice vouchers, otherwise known as Section 8 vouchers, Social Security, supplemental security income, unemployment insurance, spousal support, veterans benefits, and the like to cover housing costs. Currently, it is not unlawful to discriminate against applicants that receive those that pay their rent through those types of resources. Before moving on to enforcement, I want to emphasize that one of OHR's FTE positions, the Program and Outreach Specialist, is generally responsible for these efforts that I'm talking about. The position has been vacant for nearly a year now, so it has become a necessity for the remaining three staff members to take up the slack on these and other outreach-related activities. Enforcement. After a period of time where the paralegal position was also vacant, we had the great opportunity and the great fortune to hire Xavier Rusk in that role. He has done an amazing job of fitting into our small staff culture and taking over key responsibilities for intake, referral, and other important tasks related to enforcement. As you can see from the pie chart, the majority of the complaints we are seeing are employment-related, almost 40%. With housing complaints taking up 25% of our caseload, public accommodation complaints come in third at approximately 16%. It may also be of interest to you that 33% of all complaints are based on disability, with race and color continuing to be a frequently alleged basis of discrimination. And according to our data over the last decade, retaliation in the workplace and in housing continues to score high in terms of complaints of discrimination arising in Tompkins County.
I'm sorry, could you go back two slides? I couldn't read.
Yeah. This?
No, the one before. Oh, yeah, that one. What are the wedges?
Oh, dear. What happened?
So the orange wedge are non-jurisdictional cases, and the purple wedge is education cases.
What does non-jurisdictional mean?
Non-jurisdictional means that someone's come in and they're alleging a complaint, for example. So there's only five subject matter jurisdictions under the anti-discrimination law. They include volunteer firefighter. Okay, so as an example, if someone came in alleging a complaint about DSS mistreating them, that would be something that's not under the five protected categories that are like housing, public accommodation, volunteer firefighter, and employment. Education is usually protected federally now by the OCR, but we do still see cases like that coming in, and we assist and make referrals when necessary.
And are there percentages attached to those wedges?
Yes.
Both are 5%.
Five. Thank you.
So I think I missed something there. So there are only two wedges? I thought I was looking at three.
Enforcement is 5%. Non-jurisdictional is also 5%.
And that line between.
It's got a
little line. I think in between the two. Is that another wedge?
No, those are just two wedges. I'm sorry I can't see it well on my screen either, but.
Peter, does it have to do with this slide?
So that is another wedge. That wedge right there in the very center of the two is 0%. That's what we're seeing for volunteer firefighters. And the reason why it's showing up like that is because there's a data difference between the type of program we used and the type of program on this computer.
Peter.
While you have that slide up, I don't see what the label is on the bottom hemisphere and on that the brown hemisphere and the purple quarter sphere.
Employment is 49%, the large chunk, and to up above to the right is housing at 25%. Public accommodation is above to the left at 16%.
You can read it easier.
Peter.
It's on
the handout sheet.
I see. Okay, thank you.
It's hard to read.
Go ahead. Carry on.
Sorry about that.
Can I ask a clarification of that as well?
Is it about this?
Yeah. So is this chart, we have the power to enforce gender discrimination here locally. So is this where you see gender discrimination, which realm in the housing realm and the employment realm, or does this include the gender discrimination that we handle locally and these types of discrimination that you help people apply to the state?
Yes, well, this is the more appropriate chart. We haven't received any complaints based on that protected category. Okay, correct. And but it would show up here in terms of a protected category. And if you've been following the changing laws, sexual gender identity and expression is now being enforced by the State Division as part of the the gender that was passed, the gender law that was passed in January, took effect in January, the Gender Equality Act. So now it is also unlawful to discriminate based on gender identity and expression. It's a violation of the state human rights law.
Carry on.
Major influences. We see one of the major influences that's challenging is the lapsing of the Memorandum of Understanding with the State Division, which really limits our local enforcement capabilities. We have seen a drastic reduction in filed complaints of discrimination in our county after that point, and we do not believe this decrease is due to the sudden absence of discriminatory behavior in the workplace, housing, and places of public accommodation. And due to the narrow protections found in the current local law, OHR is limited in how it can assist persons in Tompkins County who feel they have been discriminated against. Many human rights stakeholders continue to express dismay when they are told by our office that we lack jurisdiction over many of the issues that we previously addressed or that they believe we should be continuing to address. The impact of the county's hiring freeze on our department was significant. Over the last year, prior to the hiring freeze that took place last year, two of my four FTEs resigned after being offered pretty impressive career opportunities elsewhere. Then the hiring freeze was enacted before we were able to fill those positions, and this meant that 50% of my staff positions were vacant for a period of time. And we are still trying to recover from this. Our hope is to be fully staffed again by the end of this year. Limited opportunities for staff training in 2016 because we were unable to utilize the unspent funds for training in 2016. We couldn't take advantage of enforcement training that was intended to provide us with some opportunities prior to securing some local enforcement powers. Hopefully, we will be able to achieve this in 2017. Office space continues to have an issue of accessibility in terms of especially mobility accessibility. And those are priorities for us, and we hope that this year that can be resolved in terms of making the Human Rights Office fully accessible to persons with disabilities. And there are racial and ethnic and gender bias anxieties out there in response to some of the local, national, and global events, including an increase in community and police conflict, and an increase in bigoted discourse stemming from the ongoing presidential campaign, terror attacks, all exhibiting negative racial, ethnic, religious, disability, and gender-based undertones. And after this election, I believe there will be challenges regardless of who wins the election. There will be challenges for agencies like ours. So this is what we call the boring slides, just the numbers. I'm sure you have those. The recommended budget, four full-time employees, our over-target requests, which is for training that we had hoped to do this past year, but we hope to look forward to spending those monies for enforcement training, fair housing testing, and other things related to our main goal, which is to reestablish some enforcement powers for OHR. And in addition to that, this is something that our office subscribed to when I arrived. When I became aware of the limited enforcement responsibilities given the lapse of the MOU, this kind of database was something that we let go because the use of it wasn't really that prevalent. But as we look forward to possibly reinstituting some of those enforcement activities, this definitely will become an essential tool to the work that we do. And I'm also open to the possibility that there are other offices in the county that do subscribe to these legal databases, and if there's a way to be added to a user list at a more reduced cost, I'm open to that possibility as well. Thank you very much.
Mike, Dan, Peter, Martha.
Thank you, Karen. I was a little curious about this statewide source of income coalition, though, just because we were literally having this discussion yesterday or a couple days ago. And frankly, that's a pretty big policy discussion. And I'm a little concerned that we've actually already joined something through the county. And that's kind of my concern, because we were literally only talking about choice vouchers in Section 8. And this goes all the way into, like, unemployment insurance. And it just seems to me that that opens a big can of worms for a lot of people who are, like, landlords. Like, are we not going to be able to do checks on possible tenants? Can you actually even afford this apartment? I mean, according to this, that would be discriminatory. If I were to say, well, do you have a job? And they said, no, I'm on unemployment insurance. Are we saying that people would not be able to then say, well, you're not going to be able to afford this apartment? I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting out of this. I mean, this seems to be a pretty big policy discussion that the legislature kind of should have. I don't know how it would come out, but it seems like that's pretty big. And it seems like the commission's already joined it. So that's why I'm curious.
Well, first of all, there's a number of questions that you raised. One is that source of income protection doesn't mean that a landlord or a housing provider can't inquire into the ability to pay. It's just that the law says now that even if someone is able to pay, but they pay through a Section 8 voucher, that they can be discriminated against because they, even though they can pay, and it's a legal form of payment that landlords can exclude based on that. And some of the studies that we've done at the office have shown that a preponderance of people who use those vouchers belong to protected categories. For example, disabled populations, female heads of households, race, national origin, all of those, the statistics show that they are more likely to use those types of subsidies for their housing than others. And so it has a disparate impact. The policy of restricting tenancies based on where your source of money comes from is a real barrier to housing.
But do you understand what I'm saying, too, that that's kind of like a policy discussion? That's not a...
Well, in answer to that question, all I can say is that we're often engaged in these kinds of things. We also associated ourselves with GENDA. And we're part of the statewide movement related to gender identity and expression being added to the protected category. And this group, which is just now being formed, we're just now trying to find support throughout the state, and we haven't developed yet an actual strategy for how to go forward. A lot of communities already have source of income as a protected category in their local laws. So it's a type of protection that has has been used by communities based on, you know, their situation and their needs. And I'm guessing that the state will probably move towards that at some point, but I'd be glad to be a part of any discussions that you have on policy and contribute in that way and be helpful. And if we find later down the road that there are, you know, issues that are unsupportable in terms of the strategy or the outcome, I'm open to those having those discussions.
Dan.
I wanted to ask for some clarification on your, what you listed as your second major influence, the impact of the county's hiring freeze on your department. My memory is the hiring freeze lasted a few months and was over a year ago. So can you clarify how that's affected you?
Yeah, well, I had two positions that resigned just, in July. The hiring freeze took place in August, I believe, the hiring freeze. That was right at the point where I had two vacancies. Right. And I couldn't hire because of the hiring freeze.
August 2015.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So what happened was that, in fact, we had gone through the process of canvassing for the paralegal position. And I was working with personnel to do that. And then we realized we couldn't hire Xavier because of that restriction. So we waited for a bit, and then Joe did give his permission to hire for that position, and we're very grateful for that. Xavier came in October, just prior to the lifting. I think the freeze was lifted by late October, I think. So. And then I still had another vacancy. And I had made an agreement with Joe that I wouldn't hire that position until January, which was after the hiring freeze had lifted. And I honored that agreement. And so then we went through, at the beginning of the year, we canvassed for that position and did interviews. And it rendered a very, a great candidate, and we offered the position, and after 24 hours of considering it, she turned it down because it was not enough. The salary, she realized, wasn't enough to meet her family needs. So then we went back to the drawing board, we looked at the job description, we re-canvassed, we're in the process of interviewing now. And we hope in the next few weeks we might have a full staff. So we're really excited about that.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm just curious why you cited the hiring freeze. That I'm not clear what.
Well,
the county's hired dozens of people since January. I'm just curious.
Well, what it meant for us, because we're a very small staff,
yes.
And it meant that for a period of time. You know, I was doing all of the intake. I was doing all of, and I was restricted from participating in other kinds of things that I would normally be doing. And it really, I mean, for a small office, it just had a really big impact on, you know, who did the work, how the work was done, what kind of work we didn't really have the resources to engage in. So we did give up some opportunities because we just didn't have the staff. And so it was one of the major impacts of last year was this, this whole sequence of events.
Thank you.
Peter Stein.
Hi. I believe I heard something. I looked through the sheets here, and I couldn't find it. But I thought you said in the beginning that recently the state has expanded its definition of things that can be protected against. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember whether or not you listed what these things were, and so I was wondering what was that expansion?
Okay. Well, one of the expansions is familial status and employment.
Was what? I'm sorry.
Familial status.
Familial status.
And employment. It previously only applied to housing, meaning that you couldn't discriminate against families with children. And now the state law says that you can't make inquiries into that status in employment as well. Okay. Another addition is related to domestic violence victim status, which previously only applied to employment. And since January, it now applies to housing. So
what does that mean? Just take an example of housing and domestic violence, how that hangs together.
So, for example, there are embedded in many leases this provision that if law enforcement is called to your property a certain number of times, that it's considered a violation of your lease.
Okay.
And some housing providers have used that in cases of women who call the police for protection in situations related to domestic violence. And it's actually, you see it more often than you would think, because it's just, it's dealt with broadly as a violation of the lease.
Mm-hmm.
But now these, and it's predominantly women that are impacted, are protected in housing and in employment situations. The other is gender identity and expression. Gender Equality Act made it unlawful for harassment based on gender identity and expression. So it's treated very similarly now to sexual harassment, both in the workplace and in housing and in public accommodation. It remains to be seen how these types of complaints are going to be adjudicated since they are relatively new. But those are the additional protections that we saw come into play starting January. Are there others? I think that's it.
So that's a redefinition of what's meant by gender, I guess, or it's added to the mix or something like that.
Well, sex refers to male or female, okay, and gender refers to how you express that.
Okay. All right, thank you.
I have Martha, myself, and Carol Chalk.
Thank you. So Dan asked a couple of my questions about the hiring freeze. But in your answer, you said that, and I don't remember how long the freeze was on, but you said
3 months.
Xavier came in before the freeze was over.
Yes, I said that Joe allowed, I think it was 2 weeks or so before the freeze was lifted, I was authorized to hire Xavier.
Okay, great. So, and I understand it's important to, like, wait till you have the right person and all, but, you know, that the freeze has been over a long time. So the a question on the slides on the percentages on enforcement. You got two slides. You got percentages. Can you help us with either now or send us later the round pie charts? The question is just, can you give us the total number?
Yeah, this is based on 81. The caseload was 81 cases.
The total caseload on that slide was 81. So that's the same caseload for the next slide?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, it's on there.
And I have to explain that when there are cases, we haven't got the data back yet from the state, but there are people that filed directly with the state division, and we wouldn't necessarily know that they filed unless they go through our office. So we're waiting on the data for how many residents of Tompkins County actually filed housing, public accommodation, and employment complaints directly with the State Division. And then routinely we ask the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to also share that data with us in relation to housing.
Okay. So next slide then. The protected categories. Is that the same number then?
Yes.
Okay. And your office is on the first floor. Everything is on the first mm-hmm. floor? So what's inaccessible about it?
The doors at the entrance. So in order to get into our office, you basically would have to call ahead, because the door on the sidewalk opens outward and it's not automatic. Mm-hmm. And then once you get inside the little lobby, mm-hmm. Then our suite door opens outward. So, I mean, if we have a client that is in a wheelchair or has other mobility disabilities, we can arrange that, you know, when we set up appointments for them, we can arrange to. But somebody just, we generally call them walk-ins, but that's probably not appropriate in this case. When somebody just wants to come into our office from the street, there's some significant barriers there. And sometimes they've looked on our signage on the front door, gotten our phone number, called us in the office and asked if we could open the, you know, let them in.
Right, so drop-in. So you would, I understand. We rent that space, right? We rent
yes.
it. Okay. Has that been discussed with the landlord?
We're starting discussions now. I'm working with Jackie Kipola to deal with some of the, what you would call the, violence in the workplace measures, you know, and to address all of those issues. And that certainly was on our list. And, you know, we're supposed to be, the landlord is now taking care of some other issues that are on that list. And I'm pretty sure he thinks that the door is an electric door, for example, an automatic door would be prohibitive. But I think my strategy is going to be to at least ask him to get some estimates so we know what we're dealing with and see whether we can somehow make that accessible and make it affordable.
Thank you.
Carol, I'm going to have Carol Dooley and Will and Mike go, and then I will go at the end. Go ahead, Carol.
So, two things. I'm confused about the staff numbers. So, do you have four slots currently filled in the office?
And I have four FTEs.
And the one you don't have?
When I'm fully staffed, I have four FTEs. There's the director, the receptionist, a paralegal aide, and a program and outreach specialist.
And which one is vacant?
The program and outreach specialist.
Okay, thank you. And then this office has a rich history mm-hmm. in our community, and I place a particularly high value on ensuring, as I've seen you do it, so it's really interesting to hear about this, the ways in which you're working, we work, county works, to ensure that our residents are well educated about human rights issues, whether they be employers or employees, landlords or tenants, you know, et cetera. And that they have a local place to go that with for help if there are individual issues as well as the general education. I'm trying to understand the part of what you said. If we're unsuccessful in bringing back some of the powers that this local office used to have, are you saying that then you won't be able to spend a lot of this budget? Or there's enough to do whether or not we get that those powers back?
Yeah, well, the way I see it is that the office is set up in a way that we have the human resource to do the enforcement piece. It doesn't mean additional staff. It doesn't mean, you know, it does mean some training and some, you know, continual training in these matters, but that we have the capability of doing that enforcement piece now, okay? So it's true that all my OTRs, all of my requests are based on the fact that we hopefully will change that scenario, that the office will be reinstated with some type of enforcement mechanism so that people that have complaints in our county don't have to go to the federal or state government. Currently, we're trying to be a go-between between those larger agencies and local complainants. And I can't even imagine what it would be like for them to do that on their own.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's why.
So the issue is that, and if you don't know, what happened previously is that we would have power to, to file a complaint, to do intake, to do conciliation, to do an investigation, and to make a finding. Okay? So currently, we can't do any of that right now unless, for some reason, both parties agree to submit themselves to that kind of local process. I don't have a mechanism. I don't have a statute. I don't have anything that gives me those jurisdictional powers to investigate local complaints. And people are... sometimes people don't realize that, and we're criticized for not doing it. Some people, aren't aware how limited our local law is, and that it doesn't provide protections for all of those categories. So it's a kind of a fine line that we are. Xavier is engaged every day with people with appointments and trying to assist them, because we have to refer our complaints to either HUD or the State Division of Human Rights. And it takes, it's a difficult process for most. And we're glad we're here to assist people, but it would be so much easier for citizens if they had a local enforcement mechanism instead of having things investigated over the phone and through faxes and other sorts of investigative from a distance techniques.
Karen, excuse me. I want to jump in here just 1 minute. You mentioned a local enforcement. How many counties in New York State, first of all, have human rights offices that do local enforcement? There's 62 counties, roughly.
Right.
And how many do that, local enforcement?
Well, Geneva has a local fair housing law that I enforced while I was there. It was the only FAP in New York State that wasn't a county.
That's a city, right?
Right, that's okay. A city. There are varying degrees of human rights agency types present in New York State. Some assist the state just in intake. Some have some types of local laws. I know that Westchester County, Rockland County have local enforcement, and they have MOUs with the State Division and with HUD. And there probably are a number of other counties that enjoy that status.
Let me get back to Dooley.
Yes, thank you. You have as your major goal for the year what's being talked about now, the reestablishment of local enforcement. And I'm wondering what indications you have that the state may be looking favorably on this.
Well, local municipalities have every right to establish its own local laws.
So it's doing it through a local law, not through a memo
right.
with the state.
Right. I'm open to a local law which provides some local enforcement powers for residents in Tompkins County. I'm open to, we've made another movement towards the state to encourage them to reinstate our MOU. I'm not sure about the likelihood of that, but we are exploring that possibility. In many ways, that's the ideal possibility. If we could reengage the state with an MOU and be an arm of the state, it would return the status, the kind of status we had prior, and that the state and the local office would work jointly on the adjudication of discrimination complaints, where the hearing would also take, would be the obligation of the state and not the locality. So I'm mostly interested in talking about it, having a discussion about it, what enforcement might look like, what it wouldn't look like. For me, if next year provides an opportunity for the community to start discussing about, do we need it? Maybe we don't. I mean, and if we do, what does it look like? And if it's there, who does it protect? And what is the process? And what is, I'm interested in having that discussion at every level.
Is that the kind of discussion that the commissioners would be part of?
Yes, but it's, for example, the commission certainly has a stake, and I do know that they support, local enforcement powers. But this is something that the powers that only can rest in the county, I mean, in the office, in the department of the county.
Okay. I wanted to say that, Xavier, I think you were at the MPO meeting where their Title VI plan was discussed, and I was very impressed with your familiarity with it and your suggestions to them. So I'm very glad you're on board. And Martha, thank you for asking the question about accessibility. I was very puzzled by that, and we should not let that continue.
Will.
And actually, this is building on Martha's question. I was trying to figure out, you said you need to talk with your landlord. I was trying to find in our budget book what we were paying for rent at that site, and I was astounded to find on page 139 that the rent is zero, but I'm guessing that it may be embedded somewhere else.
Yeah, no, that's not.
That is definitely not correct. Thousands of dollars. I'm somewhat protected from that because that the administration takes care of that. Jackie Kipola does that piece, and she often engages with the landlord about the negotiating the lease and such. So, but I have seen the lease, and it is.
I fully believe you, but it's just puzzling.
Kevin, Joe, are you looking it up there?
Is it in facilities budget? Is that where we put the rent for this building? I'm not sure if it's in the human rights budget or if it's in the facility.
It wasn't listed. I've never seen it in my budget.
Yeah, I think it.
Thank God.
I'm looking at facilities right now to see if I can find it there. We'll get you the number. I recall it's in the $12,000 range, but
okay. And sort of a related question: and while we're looking, I'd be curious what our lease arrangement is and how long we're locked in at that point. Thank you.
Okay, Mike Loveland. After that,
hi Karen.
Hi.
Really pleased to hear that you're trying to reengage the state about the MOU. I think that's very, very important. I think they punished us long enough for things that happened before you came on as director. And the fact that there are MOUs in other areas similar to what we used to have seems to me that it would be appropriate to get that kind of authority back. More concerned about local enforcement went that direction, because basically it would seem to me, and you can comment on this, wouldn't it make us give us a prosecutorial role in these kinds of things rather than the assembly of the information and moving it on? Wouldn't it open us up to potential litigation if we make mistakes? I'm concerned about that.
Well, litigation due to mistakes is always a possibility. But the models that are used, for example, the model that I used in Geneva, which was approved by HUD, is similar to what happened here. The local office did intake, investigation, served the parties, and gathered the evidence. They made findings and determinations. The only difference under the model that's more generally used is that if you only have a local law that's not an extension of the state, that you do have to create an adjudication piece for after a finding. And what that generally looks like is, for example, when you're dealing with housing, it's called the Fair Housing Board. It's three members who sit on a board, and they hear the evidence. And only after they decide is there actually, a finding of guilt or innocence, okay, in terms of violation of the local law. So in Geneva, that's the experience that I have. So the way it worked there was I never, out of 100 cases, not one of them went to a public hearing because of my emphasis on conciliation efforts. And I was always able to get the parties to come to an agreement or to conciliate prior to a hearing. And I think that's usually the best way of settling these issues. Not to say that Tompkins County would be the same, but the local law that I have drafted, the proposed law, has that piece in there that addresses what happens to a complaint after there's a finding of reasonable cause. And yes, it's complicated. Yes, it's long and tedious, but the process is very transparent, embedded in the proposal of the local law. It does mean that we would be responsible for that added piece that the State Division previously performed in terms of adjudicating a human rights complaint. And if there are, my ultimate goal was to kind of use that local law because once the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, sees that a locality has a local law that looks like the Civil Rights Act, they're more likely to have an MOU with us. Okay? So, and HUD is the same way. You have to have a local law that looks like the Fair Housing Act, substantially equivalent to the Fair Housing Act, before these federal agencies want to use you as an extension of their process. And so part of my strategy is to create a local law which does mirror federal and state protections, and then find ways of partnering with those entities so that we can bring resources. Now, when we did this for the State Division, we never got paid for the work that we did. We were performing all of those duties up into public hearing without any subsidy, without any payment. Okay, so in theory, the county was paying for all of that enforcement with local dollars. If you have an MOU with the EEOC or with HUD, that comes with some resources. okay, either for training or for enforcement purposes. I would be, you know, I think that it would be in the state's best interest to actually engage with us and allow us to, you know, to provide those services for them. I'm not sure whether we could get into an MOU, some kind of payment for those services, but and maybe it's a non-starter, but I would like to engage, have that discussion with the state to see whether what an MOU might look like and what kind of relationship we could have, whether it's similar to the one we had previously or if it's something that's really more beneficial to the county in terms of being paid for the services that we provide.
Thank you.
Liveland.
Thank you. Some of my questions got to ask. I appreciate you all doing that. And Mike, I'm not sure what you mean by the state is punishing us for things that we might have done. But maybe you'll explain that to me at some point.
I'm glad to. That's the way it appears to me.
So I'll be curious to hear that. And Karen, goodness knows we are well aware that we were not getting any money from the state because every year we whined about it. We're doing all this work and the state does not pay us any for it. But we realized that it was extremely important to the people of Tompkins County that we maintained doing that work because often their cases got lost in a black hole, whether they were going to New York City or to Binghamton, and we wanted to make sure that our people here were getting services as quickly as they can. I want to talk a little bit about the local law. Even with our memo with the state at that time, if my recollection is right, and you know, don't quote me on it, we would take the complaints, do the investigation, determine whether there's probable cause, but then we still have to send it to the state. We still sent it to Binghamton. They would say yes or no, you know, from everything that we have, it seems probable cause, and you proceed to whatever the next step is, whether people want to conciliate or whatever it is, you go back and forth before hearing an examiner or something, or an administrative law judge or something. If we get in place, if we enhance our own local law that we have on the books right now, so we have one that covers gender the issues. What do we do now if there are complaints that come that violate our local law C or our local law that we have in the books? What do we do now? I thought we already had a framework for what we do now.
There's somewhat of a framework, but I think you know that the local law only protects based on gender identity and
right.
expression and sexual orientation.
Right.
And we've never had the opportunity to use the local law because we haven't received any since I've been there.
Since you've been here.
Since I've been here, I haven't received any complaints based on that protected category.
And you have not seen anything that says what's the framework for how what happens if we have a complaint in there.
Yeah, I know what the local law framework is. And Xavier, you know, you want to, are you interested?
No, I don't need, okay. Right. I was just wondering if there was something that already, and I shouldn't wonder if there, I know there's something already exists. Can that same thing be in place if we have the enhanced local law? Instead of trying to recreate something, can we use the same process that we have in place now?
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the framework that's created in the local law, if we were to expand it to where the subject matter jurisdictions covered things like along the federal and state lines and also the protected categories, those things like gender, race, color, all mm-hmm. those things expanded to there, there is a framework within it for us to work with. However, the issue of investigation, the issue of making a finding, the issue of being able to actually enforce and the law doesn't really exist there. Like there's, if a respondent, for example, if we tell a respondent that they have to respond to our inquiry because there's a complaint against them, if they choose to ignore us, There's nothing that we can do without a local law that says that if you ignore a subpoena from us, then there are consequences. That's not in our current local law, the consequence part.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get at. So what we need to do is we can enhance our local law, and then we need to have the additional enforcement consequences piece added to whatever the framework is so that people know this is what's going to happen if you don't. So we have it step by step. But I just wanted to get a sense of what's happening now. Thank you for that.
I've waited long enough, and then I'll go back to Julie and Peter. Karen, there's a OTR for 14.9, and it's training for enforcement staff. So there's an assumption that we're going to be in the enforcement business. Is that what I'm getting from that?
Well, at least we're going to be trained for it. I mean, the training has to come. I would like the training to come first.
Right.
Okay. I wanted to do that last year. Couldn't really do it. So this year I'd like to focus on capacity building my staff so that when we get some kind of, opportunity for local enforcement that we can do it and we can do it well.
I have Dooley and then Peter, and we'll take a break and come back. No. Dooley, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that Will piqued my curiosity about the rent, so I looked in Appendix B under facilities, and there is an entry, Irish LLC, human rights rent, $28,975.
Okay, what page is that, Dooley?
B4.
B4. Thank you very much.
Yep.
And someone else had their hand up. Peter.
Yeah, Karen, I have a couple of questions to try to summarize what I remember as the MOU and what went on. And let me just tell you and then ask you if that's correct. It was my understanding that in the days of the MOU, when there was a complaint, we, meaning your office at that time, would investigate that complaint and write a report where they came to a conclusion of some sort, and they would then give that to the state, and the state would say, well, thank you for the report, and we will use that report as the basis of bringing it to court or whatever you call it, okay? That's what the MOU is about. Is that correct, more or less?
More or less.
Yes. And so, and if we wanted to do it ourselves, then we would have to give ourselves two things. We would have to give ourselves the investigation. We have to figure out who's going to do the investigation. And then we would also have to, by ourselves, carry out the trial, so to speak. And we need that. That expertise, which is different than the investigation. It's like the police and the district attorney or something like that. So it would seem to me that all of these things cost money, and there's nothing you can do that doesn't cost money. If you're going to have a small police force and then a small court, you know, some people get paid. And that the cheaper thing would be if we could get the MOU in, because we wouldn't have to provide the adjudication part. Is that more or less correct? That
more or less.
Okay, thank you.
Anna, last thing, okay?
Absolutely. So I'm clearly on a steep learning curve. So this question might, I'm still trying to put all the pieces together. I'm glad that both of you are here. So the 15,000 is training and the testing. And given the current context of what everybody's been talking about the law or lack of pieces of an enforcement, the training, I understand, the testing is to build an understanding of what the current climate is that the context, is just to understand the climate? Isn't there enforcement part within that?
Yes. There's two types of testing. There is audit testing, and there is there is enforcement testing. So when we, if you recall, when we were doing the analysis of impediments to fair housing choice, we did 30 fair housing tests for audit purposes only, which meant that the tests that came back positive were not adjudicated. They were not considered the basis of complaints. They were purely for auditing purposes to do what you suggest, which is to get a sense of the climate of the community, what kinds of barriers are there, you know, what kind of discriminatory acts are taking place and to what degree, just for, you know, data purposes. The fair housing testing that we're proposing here is not for audit purposes. It is for complaint purposes. So, say for example, we do the 15 tests, and we see it's analyzed, and it turns out to be a positive paired test that shows some form of discrimination. Then we would refer that complaint at this point, because we don't have any. If we had local enforcement powers, we could address it way more effectively. But at this point, we would have to file a complaint and send it to a state or federal agency.
And that goes to HUD?
Yes.
Okay.
But there's also a possibility of conciliation. One reaction to a positive test would be to go to the housing provider and make them aware that the test took place. We could provide educational training, whatever is necessary in order to prevent it from happening in the future.
Okay. That all is coming together.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we're finished with OHR now. Probation is next. And Community Justice Department. And just so you know, we're officially 1 hour over.
You seem to do
and
that every
I guess
night.
I'll take responsibility for that.
We all share.
Sorry to ruin your dinner plans.
Oh, that's your wife. Thank you.
Probation, thank you for coming. Next, we'll move on.
Well, good evening, everyone. So I think I'll help you get back on track, because
right.
I don't have any jazzy slides, or and my mantra 1 year ago was probation is stable. That continues to be the case. So I don't have like a whole lot of things to dwell on tonight, but we'll just go ahead and get started and see how long it takes us to get through this. The first slide here, the expenditures and revenues, that 6.56% jump in change really reflects a couple of things, salary and fringes for the next year, as well as the $100,000 that was added to the probation budget that will pay for the reentry services that we will be entering into a contract with Cooperative Extension. That contract's not exactly signed yet, but we're very close to getting that signed. Full-time equivalents, no change. We've been stable for several years now, so we continue to have a staff of 34. Major influences. Well, I just talked about the reason why the expenditures went up. That's due to the reentry services now being a part of our budget. And the other major influences that contribute to our stability, our state funding and block grant has remained stable. There's been no decrease. For many, many years, we were getting decreases, but that has remained flat for, I think, the last 3 to 4 years in funding. So that has been good. Our FTEs remain stable, and the workload within the department remains fairly stable. Couple of things, future unknowns. This is the slide might look familiar. It's the exact same slide I used last year in my budget, because nothing happened with raise the age legislation. You know, we did review a couple draft versions, and it just didn't get picked up. There was no support. The governor supports it, but the legislature and the Senate, there wasn't enough support. Of importance to know is that there's 100% funding for additional probation workload that was promised in the last version. My understanding is that that's still hopefully part of the deal, but we'll see in the next version. I anticipate we'll probably be reviewing something at the beginning of the year or the end of this year in a new version of that legislation. Last year, I also indicated that we had a future unknown with the Ithaca Community Treatment Court. I believe I indicated that Judge Wallace had taken over that court, and we were going to be watching the caseload size closely just to make sure, you know, I anticipated there would be a rise in numbers. There have been a rise in numbers, but it's still manageable with one FTE supervising that caseload. But I'm still watching because, as you all know, we have a lot of people with serious addictions, and that doesn't seem to be going away. And the last future unknown does have to do with reentry services and just basically how it ties into our day reporting program. Basically, I want to make sure that that the use of the facility, you know, that it doesn't impact the day reporting programming per se and the staffing. I do want there to be good collaboration. I have offered up an office to the reentry coordinator to be able to collaborate with my employment specialist and with the GED and the BOCES contract for GED and life skills so that reentry participants can come in there either during day reporting hours or subsequent to the day reporting when it ends so that they could have services available. But I just want to make sure that all that's streamlined and things run smoothly. So that's a little bit of an unknown, but I really think that's a work in progress, and once we get started, you know, we'll be able to mesh that all out.
Questions for Patricia?
And that is it.
Dooley.
I'm looking at the contracts appendix, Appendix B, which has gone way up from $60,000 to $175,000. Is that where the $100,000 for reentry is shown?
I'm sorry, Dooley. I could not quite hear you.
I'm looking at our Appendix B, which shows contracts.
What page?
Yes.
B9. It's just a big jump, and it's very close to $100,000, and I wondered if that's where the reentry money is showing up.
Oh, yes, yes. That is exactly where that, okay, that money was put. Yes.
Thank you.
Martha.
Hi, Pat. You mentioned with Judge Wallace you thought the treatment court numbers would, well, they've been going up a little bit. Mm-hmm. The court reform task force, I maybe got the title wrong, that Ray Slaughter chaired, one of their recommendations was a third county court that would focus on DWI. If we were able to get that, would that increase your workload? It might increase the sort of speed by which investigations have to be turned around, and I mean, would that impact your department at all?
No, because it's really based on the arrests and how many cases come through the system. So, no, that would not affect the workload, I don't think.
Okay.
I don't think so.
No. All right. And part of the reentry program was extending the days, the hours of day reporting. Is that going to get started once Davi and Lisa are really actually working with people?
Yes.
And,
yes. Okay. First we need referrals, and you know, people need to be identified as who needs services or wants services, and then once we get some numbers, we can decide how to fit them into the day reporting schedule. I mean, it may be they can just come into the normal day reporting hours and sit in the GED classes during the scheduled times that we offer those classes. It may be the GED instructor, depending on how many need GED services, will hold separate classes for reentry participants after the 1:30 time period. So I think we're going to try to be fluid with that.
Okay. Do you think there would be, is there any issue, do you think, with mixing people who've been incarcerated with people who...
Well, that's something I want to kind of take a look at. I mean, most of the day reporting participants, not most, but many are there pretrially, so they are coming from the jail or they have been referred to the program in lieu of sitting in jail. So those people weren't formally incarcerated to begin with. But we also have other people there. We have some kind of, the drug court sanctions come through in lieu of going to jail. So, yeah, we want to make sure that the program is running really smoothly and well for everybody so that everyone gets a good use of the program.
Okay. All right. Thank you. This is a general question, I guess, to Joe. If something gets going with the city and the Ithaca plan, the drug plan, maybe we should talk about it in HHS. I don't know if there's anything we think we need to beef up. You know, anything that we've should be doing in that context. I don't know if we've really talked about it.
Yeah, at this point, I think the focus has been on leads. I mean, that's been the one thing that's grown out of it that we have, and Peter's been very involved in this, has embraced. And I don't know that that's going to carry a heavy cost. It's more of an organizational challenge. How do you create that hub-and-spoke arrangement of referrals? It's something that we're going to be looking into over the next few weeks or months. That's the only Leslie, you're familiar with the truth. Is that about it?
Thank you. Thank you, Pat, for your
See, concise. I helped you get back on schedule.
That's it. Well, you're helping. Youth Services, Amy, is here.
You're doing a hot pat.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Okay. Just like a little fall theme. And like Teresa said, on our computers it looks different. Okay, so Youth Services 2017 budget. And I always start our budget presentations with a few things that I know at least the county administrator would be sad if we missed. So we'll start with the mission. This is the Youth Services Department, invest times, resources, and funding in the communities. And then we'll move into the pyramid. This is what Joe would really miss. So this is the pyramid of how we fund the programs and oversee the programs that we provide in the community. What this pyramid shows is at the bottom is really recreation, which is a universal prevention method. And that's kind of the basis of the pyramid of youth services. As you move up the pyramid, the programs become more costly and the number of youth served actually becomes less. So the hope is you could serve as many youth as possible in recreation programming. However, we know that's not the case. Not all youth fit into that programming model. So you move up into kind of an early intervention and youth development program model, and we use primarily the municipal youth service system, although there are components of youth development in everything that the youth services funds. You move the next tier up is targeted intervention, where we provide agency services, and then at the very top are our partners in Department of Social Services and Juvenile Justice and other areas that we work with for treatment and placement. The bottom three tiers is primarily where we're funding services. The top tier we still provide a lot of planning and coordination around. So this is our recommended budget. And here's some of the major influences as we prepared this budget. So this was a conclusion of a three-year grant cycle. On the agency services side, we fund different agencies in the community to really provide services throughout Tompkins County, looking for diverse services, serving a number of different audiences. Some of our providers may be very targeted on their services, and that's okay. We really look to fund a full continuum. We put out an RFP for that back in April, I believe. We received requests of over $600,000, and we really only have about $300,000 that we're using in that agency side. So my resource allocation committee had quite a task at hand, and that's what the recommendations you see before you. We also had to look at planning and coordination support, so my department staffing, how we're stabilizing that as well as expanding a lot of our services. We've been doing a lot of different things in the community with other agencies and other departments, and some of that you've heard about already, working with the Workforce Development Board and youth employment to really become very knowledgeable on what's happening in the youth employment realm and be the experts there. Along with this is we've really dove into results-based accountability and understanding the program performances, how they're performing, what they're doing, how do we really measure the effectiveness of the programming that we're funding. So we've looked at results-based accountability. We're now 2 years into this model and really have a clear understanding of how we're targeting young people, how they're being served. Some of the things that we're finding from this is we may have a program that we think is serving 300 young people, but then when we look a lot deeper, we find they are having those 300 young people come through their doors. But with one case manager, they're really targeting about 60 young people, making a huge difference, and they really don't have the resources to support what they could be doing. So it's been very much pulling the lens back or pulling the curtain back to see a little bit closer how our agencies are operating and ways that we can support them. On top of that is something called Achieving Youth Results, and that's looking at the county as a whole and what the goals are of the county to serve young people. And so there's really six goals around Achieving Youth Results, and we've been in all of the communities asking for how do we make these goals happen. And they're very simple goals, things like economic security for families, helping families thrive, making sure that we have strong educational systems. So how do we do that as a youth services department, and then how do all of our partners build on that? So that really provides us metrics of success for the population level. Another major influence is our New York State Office of Children and Family Service funding has been shifting. They have really focused on their funding going directly to services, which is agreeable. However, in order for services to operate, there has to be support behind that. We did receive funding starting last year, and we received it again this year, to put forward a new initiative for sexual exploitation among youth. It's been really well received. We have a strong media campaign that will be rolling out in the near future to talk about what that looks like here in Tompkins County. However, there was no funding for the administration behind that, so it was only for those campaign materials. All of that time has been found other ways. While costs have continued to increase, contract funding, so we do provide contract funding to all the municipalities as well as agencies, we have not done a cost of living increase in those allocations since prior to the recession. That also means our contract partners have come forward and said, you know, they're reducing some services or they're also looking elsewhere to try to cover those rising expenses. On this, the other thing that we are starting to hear from our partners, our contracted partners, is under the new FLSA regulations, how that's now impacting them. Because we're seeing programs that have overnights, and suddenly they're now hourly employees. And so how that impacts service delivery is very difficult for our partners to take on. Another thing that I'm extremely proud of is our training series. So as we've started looking at these performance measures, looking at program quality assessments, we've identified that there's a lot of trainings that youth workers could use to help benefit their services. So beginning this year, we actually last year we did a soft launch, and this year we've really dove in a little deeper. We've had 328 youth workers come to trainings on a variety of topics. And so some of the trainings included, you can see here or in your handouts, things like project-based leadership, how to understand summer camp scholarships, which is a very difficult system, strength-based strategies, building inclusive environments, much more. Our last training, which was held last week, we actually had a waiting list and had to cap that training at 45 participants. So it's been really taking off. And this was an area where often agencies and organizations don't have large training budgets to be sending their youth workers to training. So we filled that void. As we look at 2017, during this federal fiscal year, we will be losing the Sober Truth on Preventing Underage Drinking, which is a grant we received for the Community Coalition for Healthy Youth. Some of you will remember that grant was a 10-year grant. It was a quite a large cycle, the CCHY original grant. That disappeared 2 years ago now. This STOP Act grant, as it's called, allowed us to maintain some of those services. This will be the end of all funding for that Community Coalition for Healthy Youth, which is really focused on working with young people in preventing use of alcohol and other drugs.
Well, they haven't stopped drinking.
You know, we tried, Leslyn. They gave us 3 years. So these are our full-time equivalents. One note on this, in 2016, we are at 5.5 FTEs. When this was prepared last year, we were hopeful that we would be bringing in additional resources to push us up to 6 FTEs. In 2016, that didn't happen. So we actually, the percent change is flat. And then on to the over-targets. So our first over-target request, you can see, is really a bundled request. This is three different areas. The reason this is the way that it is how my resource allocation committee looks at rollover. So they actually look at rollover as a separate category from target funding. So when they put this together, they asked me to keep it together. And so there's a threefold use of rollover. One is to continue to support that training series. I will say we're starting to look at how we can sustain that in the future because we are having such a good turnout. We want to sustain that. However, we're also very cautious because as we start to talk to people, there are other trainings in the community. So we're learning from others why maybe our attendees aren't going to those trainings. Is it what we're doing? Could someone else take that on? Or is it cost prohibitive? What we're finding resoundingly is it's cost prohibitive because what we're looking at is some agencies are sending 7 staff members to one training because they need the training hours and they can't afford to send 7 staff members to some of these trainings. Right now they're all free through us. So we're looking at that for rollover again this year as we start to change that system a little more. Next year will be the 40th anniversary of the Youth Services Department. So we're looking at launching what we're calling One Caring Adult. You'll hear a lot more about that. As I hope you all realize, we don't actually serve any young people at the Youth Services Department. We work with the adults that support them all. And so what we've decided to do is really focus on how important adults are in the lives of young people. And so we're working with a speaker and some other folks around the community to start identifying who the adults are in the community that have helped shape the young people and the leaders that are in our community now. And then the third one makes us laugh every time because it is a purchase of office chairs. And so when we researched them, we were surprised how expensive office chairs are. Yes, you know. And so we would like to purchase new office chairs for our staff as they have not been replaced since the building was built. So that's the other piece. Over-target request not supported by the recommended budget. This is, the first one is actually an increase for agencies funded by youth services. So that would include our municipalities as well as the agencies. Looking at what is being increased on the agencies that contract directly to the county, the resource allocation team really felt like they should request that our contracted agencies also get a similar increase. And as I had mentioned, we have heard from those agencies that they're struggling. The $10,000, which is priority 3, is also a way to increase some of the contract side of things right directly in the agencies. We did receive a lot of additional requests. We are able to fund one additional program, but we're only able to fund that at a half the rate of what they had asked for. So they asked to actually expand that program a little bit more. So this would allow them to continue to expand the outing program at the Ithaca Youth Bureau. And so that concludes this portion. Rec partnership is separate. I do have that as well, but I can take questions on this piece now.
Let's do the whole thing.
Do it all? Okay.
We'll do the questions.
All right, so rec partnership. Rec partnership recommended budget, you can see here. And, of course, the revenues are from the other municipalities, so that's how this breaks down. Forgot I did that. The major influences on this budget is the increasing operating costs. So the costs for doing business continue to increase, although the budgets don't always do that.
There is an over-target request that's not supported by the tentative budget, and that is the REC partnership has asked all partners to increase by 5.9%. The REC partnership is receiving the 2% increase by all agencies, but has asked for the additional 3.9%, so that way they're maintaining the same increase as all the other municipalities. And that is the end.
Questions on either portion here? Anna, go ahead, and then Carol.
It's not exactly a question. I just wanted to expand. I'm the REC partnership liaison, one of the two liaison people, and what was discussed at the meetings was the struggle to maintain the existing programs or to cut them. Mm-hmm. And so all this does is to maintain the existing programs that are already there. And it was very heart-wrenching because a lot of people on the REC partnership were parents, and a lot of the programs being considered for being cut would directly affect children that they knew. And so all of them went back to their municipalities and fought to maintain the existing status, not expansion, just to maintain. So I very much appreciated the effort and the willingness of the other municipalities, and I'm hoping that the legislature does step up to support that.
Carol.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand the OTR for the earlier portion, number 82, the $12,859, you have a lot of agencies here that total a whole lot more than that would be 2% of. So I'm just trying to understand which ones either did or didn't get their 2%.
So it's a 2% increase on only county funding. So that would cover all of the agencies we contract with. It would be a 2% increase on what funding they currently receive from the county.
And which are the ones that won't get it if we don't fund this? Because you have like $1 million worth of contracts in here.
They'll all receive a 2% increase. On proportionate to the county funding. So they'll all receive a 2% increase on what funding they receive that's county funding.
Well, maybe I'll have to ask you later, because it just doesn't seem like $12,000 is enough. If they're not getting 2% now, $12,000 isn't enough to give all of them 2%.
We do have a chart of it, so I can share that so you can see how it breaks out. It's not a substantial amount of money. I mean, some of them, it's a little more than a few hundred dollars, but there it is. I think at minimal it's about $300, and at maximum around about $1,300. So it's not a lot of funding to those agencies, but it's more in good faith effort that we are attempting to help them a little bit, relieve some stress.
County is not from county.
Okay, thank you. Will, and then Martha.
Hi, Amy. I was looking through the agencies that you support, and some are up and some are down. For example, the Municipal Youth Services, and that's hard to say, is going up by about $80,000. Is that reflective of state funding? Or
the municipal system is going up because of... Where are we seeing that?
That's on page 294 of our book.
There was the, I'm assuming that what you're talking about, Will, and I don't have it in front of me, is last year was this year for 2016 there was that increase of $75,000 that came in from this body, and so that's what I would be assuming. Oh, I see what you're... Yeah, that's what you would be looking at, is that additional $75,000.
Was that a one-time then?
It's ongoing.
It's ongoing with the numbers. Okay, all right, got it. And secondly, several of the agencies are down. For example, you know, several years ago, I remember we had a big push on Big Brother, Big Sister. That's cut. And mm-hmm. You know, is there a case to be made that they should be restored, or is this making sense to them?
So this is something that the Resource Allocation Committee had to struggle with. So they received multiple proposals. Some did not receive any funding. They hadn't been funded in the past. What we do with our agencies is every three, I'm hoping for five, but every 3 years we ask for all agencies, it's a fresh year. So you have to compete again through that RFP process. So then the resource allocation team treats everyone as a brand new agency.
Okay.
And so when they look at that service, they were asked to make sure that they really focused on serving countywide, high-quality programs that are cost-effective. They looked at the ratios of participants and then at standards and best practices around that, and then made decisions based on those conclusions that they came to based on the proposals. So that's why some of the previously funded received funding again. However, it's a new year, so it's a brand new fresh start. So what we have told those agencies, if they receive the funding, if it's all approved, they will have a 3-year contract pending funding to remain hopefully at that level, or if there's an increase or if there's a decrease, we'll deal with it then, unless there's a performance challenge, and then we would look at the contract. This time, though, when I said I'm hoping for five, we did offer what the RFP said was three with a potential to extend to 5 years. So there's some more longevity rather than every 3 years potentially starting over.
Okay. And so your internal recommendation, or your committee that's recommended, sent this back, and have you heard from any of the agencies that you're decreasing a grade level on happiness, and are we going to be hearing from them when it gets to the public?
I never know what will be said. I'm sure it's not with great level of happiness. I hope that there is an understanding of the process and that we are trying to look at how we can sustain it. I have had the discussion with one of the executive directors about sustainability of funding and looking for other sources to potentially backfill this if in 3 years it were to shift again. But there are some agencies that also received increases. I did hear from them very quickly.
I bet you did. Thank you very much.
Martha.
Yes, Amy, would you explain this request about the outing program? I'm confused about this.
So when those agencies all put in their funding applications, Outing actually requested additional funding, so they requested $20,000. When we looked at, as a committee, when we looked at all of the possibilities, they decided that there were components of the program, and so with the $10,000, it appeared that they could fund a component but not the full program. We have not funded Outing. We funded Outing a long time ago. We have not funded it recently. So the committee recommended that we fund at least the component, but request to fund the full program if we were able to through OverTarget.
Okay, so who's been running it?
It's run currently by the Ithaca Youth Bureau, and they had other sources of funding. They still have other sources of funding. So that's the thing. Most of our contract agents, all of our contract agencies, have a much larger budget than we provide. We just provide for some a sliver and for some substantial amount.
Okay, and then Joe, on the OTR for the REC partnership, you denied that again because you hate kids?
That's correct. Okay. I do hate kids. The truth is now out.
No, it just didn't fit in the budget.
Well, it didn't fit in the budget. All the agencies, the direct contract agencies, received the same 2%. So that's what we had proposed for them. What they're asking for is a 6% increase. Frankly, I can't wrap my head around why it takes a 6% increase to maintain current levels of program, given that we're in a 2% inflation environment and other things. So those are the things that brought me to that place.
Okay. All right.
Rich and then Mike.
Just what is the outing program?
I'm sorry, Rich, I didn't hear.
What is the outing program?
So the outing program is a lot like it sounds. It gets kids really outside and into nature, and I'm probably doing a pretty horrible job at it. So I will ask Suki Tabor, who's here from the Ithaca Youth Bureau and was looking up, Liz is also here, to explain briefly what outings does.
Has a number of components that
Can someone turn that on?
Oh, Suki, if you want to come here.
It has a number of components that it does, but the funding for that we're asking the county for focuses on the component known as pathfinders. They've done a pilot with pathfinders through the Safe Routes to School funding that the city got. So they've been doing that for 2 years now. So the Pathfinders program is a school year program designed to bring together fourth and fifth graders for a five-week series of biking and outdoor team building activities. They're designed to help promote friendships across elementary school and geographic lines and help ease the transition into middle school. Full funding of Pathfinders with the over-target request makes this program available to fourth and fifth graders in all eight elementary schools of the Ithaca City School District. With reduced funding, fewer series or blocks of programming would be available, fewer children would be able to be served, and it would make it challenging for the staff in the outing program to serve all eight elementary schools. So full funding would allow us to serve 150 to 200 youth, whereas without the OTR, the numbers would have to be reduced to 75 to 100 youth. And previous programs of this type that the outing program has run have really demonstrated really positive impacts in helping students more easily navigate the transition into middle school. Some of the other program components that outings runs include canoeing and camping, backpacking, hiking, rock climbing. So really a lot of outdoor adventure. They do a lot of team building and programs that are designed to help kids challenge their perceived boundaries and abilities beyond what they normally think they can do. So,
Mike?
Amy, you mentioned the Fair Labor Standards Act problem. I think that's going to be pervasive in not-for-profits particularly. I wonder, is there, as a group, are they thinking about getting together and trying to figure out ways and tactics to comply?
Yes, they are. There has been many conversations. I've had conversations with a couple of the executive directors. I think that they all are coming up with ways to comply, but a lot of the ways they're going to comply is by cutting what they're doing. And so we've actually already seen some staff that have decided this is no longer for them because they're feeling bound by the Fair Labor Standards Act, because we have some staff that are working many more than 40 hours and are feeling like they can't perform in those limits. So I did have that conversation recently with one of the managers. So I think that it's going to be some difficult growing pains, but in theory, this is a very positive act. It's not trying to harm the programs. It's actually trying to help the staff, and I think that people are starting to see that, but it's going to be a difficult year.
Does everyone understand what this issue is about? You want to explain it?
Sure. So this issue is a lot of our program staff are not paid the minimum Fair Labor Standard Act to be to be salaried employees, so they will now become hourly employees. In the past, a lot of them were salaried employees and worked many more hours than the 40-hour work week. They were also able to shift their hourly work. So we have programs in some of our municipal youth services system who go on 2- and 3-day overnights. If you're looking at a 2-day overnight, depending on the youth, there's a lot of different models on how to account for the time. However, if a young person wakes up at 1 in the morning and needs support, that's work time. So there is a lot of concern from all of these providers on how do they continue to operate the programs. What we're seeing, some of the solutions we're seeing, especially around the overnights, is there won't be programs offered maybe the week before or the week after, and that's your program. Under youth development, one of the big pieces is to have continuous support by adults that is consistent, and so this changes some of that consistency. So there's a lot to struggle on this.
But they have to
stay within 40 hours.
They have to stay in 40 hours, or they could increase the salaries. That's the other piece, is you could increase the salary or the wages, so then they become salaried.
Isn't that about $46,000?
It is.
They have to be paid in order to do that?
It is.
And if they go over 40, then they have to be paid time and a half.
Time and a half. That's another way people are looking at, is they are some of the creative ways I've heard executives kind of come up with how to handle this is putting in kind of a bank of overtime hours. So potentially reducing salary. So now their hourly wages are slightly less. They have a bank of time and a half money that they can then pull on. So in the end, their wages stay the same.
So they're cutting hourly rates.
Mm-hmm. Carol.
So this last may have partially answered my question, which was kind of a follow-up to the issue of why might it take a 5-point-something% bump up to meet the program need that where you're not increasing the programs. But I was going to ask whether you know how many of these agencies you're working with are managing to pay a living wage, or if not that substantially, if they are, how many of them are paying anything substantially above a living wage, the minimum?
They all are paying a living wage. Substantially, I'm not sure above the living wage how many of the agencies, but they are all paying living wages at this point.
Well, if they're needing to deal with this, how do you pay people enough to either get them above the 40 hours that they're actually working or increase their salaries, that gets you well above the 5% in increase. So it's an issue. Thank you.
Martha.
Well, I guess it would help us if we had something in writing from the REC partnership and the board or whatever to kind of explain that better. I'm a little puzzled about the outing program again. So on page 291, your description of OTRs, it says you've requested 10,000. Mm-hmm. Zero was recommended. Then on page 295, it's zero in 2016, so that's what we haven't funded it so far. But 2017 is 20,000 and change. So first I'm confused why are they two different numbers?
Yeah. So it's a brand new. The reason it's zero in 2016 is because it's a brand new program. So we haven't supported it in the past.
It's not a new program. It's a new program to us, right?
Right. It's a new program to us. Sorry.
Okay.
So in that way, it's and so what we are requesting is 20,147. We were able to cover 10,147. Oh, okay. So 10,000 we were able to cover in the OTR. 147 would be their 2% increase, and then the other additional 10,000 we asked for in target. So we have target, OTR, and then the 2% also in another OTR.
Okay. Now, what's the total funding for this program? And we've been talking about total funding versus our share, and I'm not interested in every one of these, but
just a second, and I can let you know. I know I have it here.
Is this again? I can get back to you later, or can you do this now?
I can do it right now if I can find the cover.
Well, I assume their total budget is not 20,000, right?
No, it's not. It's quite a bit more.
Yeah,
and Suki has it right there. It's 145,000.
So the total is 145.
For outing?
For outing.
So how does, if they get 10,000 versus 20,000, it's going to cut the number of kids they can serve in half, mm-hmm, out of a $145,000 budget?
The $145,000 budget is for the entire outing program rather than just the Pathfinders program. The $20,000 is just for the Pathfinders program, that component of the outing program.
Okay. How much is the Pathfinders program?
The Pathfinders program requested $20,000. That allows us to put in place the staff and the infrastructure to make that program possible.
And that's new.
So that's new. That's not existing in...
We currently have funding through the Safe Routes to School grant, which will end mid-year next year. So we're piloting. It's been piloted last year and this year.
At how much money for Pathfinders? $20,000?
Safe Routes to School is a whole different pot of money, and it works completely differently. But based on the model of Safe Routes to School, we were able to figure out how we could do Pathfinders for $20,000.
And $20,000 will serve 150 to 200 kids, and $10,000 will serve 75 to 100 kids.
Yes.
Thank you.
Anna, last question on this, please.
I wanted to address quickly what Joe brought up about the 2% to the 6%, and realized that I can't do it justice like Liz could, and I would love to ask if Liz could come up for just a minute to talk about why it's the 6%. To maintain the programs and that it's not an increase. Is that possible?
Hi, I'm Liz Vance, formerly Liz Vance, now Liz Kloman, Director of the Youth Bureau. And the reason for the increase is to take care of the living wage increases, the minimum wage increases, and the contractual salaries that we have with staff who run the program. We have had many years without increases. The city also went through a compensation study for our employees who are in the CSEA admin unit. And because of that admin unit, we have done step increases over the years. In addition to the step increases, they signed a new contract for 2016 going forward into 2017 and 2018, and that has resulted in an increase that we have to cover to run the same program. So that's the reason why for the additional request.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you all very much. I'm going to put the History Center up. It's a one-pager, and Rod has been patiently waiting. And I'm going to do the county attorney, and I'm going to leave cooperative extension until the end. So Mr. Howe is here. And it's, you know, pretty simple.
Thank you very much for doing that. Good evening, everyone. We always appreciate your support. With me is a trustee. Jim Johnson is over here. He's also our treasurer. I told him he didn't need to come up, but if the questions get hard, I'll signal him to come up, although he's fairly new. So I do think this is pretty straightforward. We got the 2% increase like everyone else for our base allocation for 2017. We are asking for, you may remember that last year you approved a one-time over-target request for $25,000, which was to support an office manager bookkeeper position to be shared with Historic Ithaca. We are asking for that again. It's a one-time over-target request, but this time at a level of $20,000 to signal that we know that we can't always count on that money. So that's how you get to the $130,088. The office manager shared position, office manager shared bookkeeper position has been very helpful to me, and it's helped to continue build relationships with our sister organization, Historic Ithaca. I changed this to say major initiatives rather than major influences, but to me they're kind of the same. I mean, we really are identifying ourselves as a generation-to-generation education and research center. So the influences really are the types of things that we're doing to play that role well, meaningfully, and to be impactful to the residents of Tompkins County. So I think you know our core programs. They're listed there. I've listed some of our newer initiatives that are ongoing. And then, of course, as you know, we've been spending time thinking about our future and where we may end up once we leave the Gateway Plaza. I've already mentioned that this is how we came up with the $130,000. We are asking for a one-time funding again for the support of the bookkeeper office manager position. I think that's it for slides. So I'm here to answer any questions.
Questions for Rod. Martha.
Hi, Rod. I know you don't like this stay to late meeting, so thanks very much for staying around. I guess if the question is, first, I'm really glad to see the newer initiatives with the bicentennial for the county and the women's suffrage centennial. What can you give us any update on moving and what the kind of new initiative you've been talking about with other organizations is, and if there's private real estate stuff, don't tell us.
We continue to explore this concept of a heritage education center that would have us co-located with other history, heritage, cultural organizations. We think that makes a lot of sense. We've been meeting with those other potential partners. We see synergies. We see down the road maybe some sharing of additional staff or even sharing support systems like printers and that type of thing. But we really see it more as of being a great service to county residents, but also to visitors. We're providing some leadership for, I think you obviously know that the county has a new heritage tourism implementation plan. The History Center has been providing leadership for moving forward on that. And so this heritage tourism actually relates very well to the concept of a heritage education center.
Thank you. And how long does your lease last? Remind us when your lease is up for.
Our lease goes through the end of 2018.
2018. Okay. Thanks very much.
Anyone else? Thank you very much.
Okay.
And could I speak to you over here on the way up? Jonathan Wood, County Attorney.
Good evening. I know we're running late, so I'll get kind of right to the slides. The recommended budget, as you can see, expenditures. The increase in expenditures there is the result of salary and fringes. There's also 5 hours of Susie's time, which was previously paid by administration, which I asked them to do because she was serving as CJATI chair, which is generally an administration program. But it's turned out that it's taken way more than 5 hours, and it's becoming more and more of an issue, particularly with the jail. So the county administrator and I decided that it makes sense to put that back in the county attorney's budget, Susie's 5 additional hours back in the county attorney budget. And obviously we need to, not necessarily the county attorney, but the county administrator and other departments really need to devote more effort into the CJATI programs, particularly in light of the recent jail issues. On the revenues, they're up very slightly, only because the Solid Waste Department has decided to pay us an extra $510 this year versus last year. As some of you know, the Solid Waste Department, because I do significant work for them or help them out on various things, they pay, and that works out somewhat well because that is able to come out of the solid waste fee instead of out of the tax rate. So long as the solid waste fee remains relatively stable, its ability to pay some money to the county attorney's office without burdening the taxes. Going to the next slide, the full-time equivalence hasn't changed at all. I did want to explain the over-target request. The over-target request was actually suggested by the county administrator in our meeting. We have a line for travel training in our budget, and this year we already have used up the total of it. Last year we used up the total of it, and in fact, if you recall, last year I had a rollover of $1. And everybody asked, or several people asked, how it came out that I had exactly $1, and I said, oh, just perfect budgeting. But the truth is we ran out of money and just didn't spend any more, and actually when we traveled, et cetera, we kind of took it out of our own pockets, and we're already used up for this year. And the county administrator suggested, well, we really should put in another $1,000 in there. Of course, he did not support it as a recommended budget item, but I would ask for that because we really need that money. We'd simply have those expenses and charges that we just don't have enough money for. And that's all I really have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mike and Dooley. Carol.
John, with the potential raising of the JD age, are we going to need more staff in your office to handle that?
I don't think so. You know, we'll have to see over time because, you know, I mean, we are very busy, and our JD staff is very busy with that. But the amount of increase, that also has an effect on probation, you know, as you know, who was here before. So how much it will increase our load as opposed to probation's load, I think remains to be seen, but we're not asking for any more. But, I mean, it is possible that several things changing at the state level, including the age, and in terms of also what happens with juvenile delinquents and PINs after they are adjudicated, you know, in terms of what the facilities, et cetera, are available, could affect the budgets of ours, DSS, as well as probation. And it's something which is really, we kind of have to let it play out. So I don't think any of us are asking for more money at the moment, but it could happen.
I know there was a lot of talk about the state holding the municipalities harmless for these costs. So I would hope that you keep track of what extra costs there are so that if that funding does become available, we can put in for it.
Yeah, and we intend to do that, and I'm sure probation and DSS do too.
Ed Dooley and then Martha, I think. Now Carol, whatever. Go ahead, Dooley.
Jonathan, isn't continuing legal education a requirement for lawyers?
Yes, it is.
And shouldn't, so let me interrupt then. It seems to me that that's something an attorney should pay for himself rather than having us pay it, or the attorneys.
Well, I mean, to respond to it, the continuing legal education that we actually do is completely related to our job. So even if we didn't get CLE credit for it, it is things that the county really should pay for, putting aside whether the county should pay for CLE. I believe the county should pay for CLE, period. That's certainly what most law firms, et cetera, do. But the things that we do, I mean, training on juvenile delinquency changes in the law, for example, I mean, included in this is going to the association meeting with the other county attorneys. Several things to our county's advantage have come out of that. In fact, from the last one, we got the assigned counsel agreement. That's where that all started at. So, you know, it is directly related to our work, and it really is you know, even if it wasn't CLE, maybe we really shouldn't even refer to it as CLE. You get credit for it, but it is directly related to the work.
And you said firms usually pay for it. If you were in practice by yourself, you would be paying for it yourself. And any, I thought any attorney had to do that anyway. I understand your argument. The county should pay for it. I have a different view. That's all.
Shocking. Carol.
Yeah, I was trying to get it whether the anticipation that this is going to be an ongoing target need. What was the other travel and training that you've done that's used up the budget? So I just give us a sense of why this, you're seeing sure. this as an ongoing thing.
Yeah, it is an ongoing thing, and it's been year after year. I think it's fun because we have a bunch of travel and expenses that we have which are covered out of risk management, but some are not. So I'll give you some examples of some are not, which we had in the past year. We had an appeal in the third department in Albany on a JD case. The JD case doesn't come out of risk management. It comes out of this fund. Just this week, I was at the hydro facility meeting with the people from Gravity over agreements, et cetera, getting the hydro. That comes out of this budget, not from others. The County Attorney Association meeting. I mean, I could go on, but there are quite a few things that fall into this budget.
Yeah, so I'm trying to get an understanding of whether this year was how this year was different than all the years, you know, last year and the year before and the year before.
Well, that's
that,
what I'm saying. It really wasn't. Last year we ran out of money, and this year we're running out of money.
Thank you. I was gonna say in opposition to Dooley's comment, I was gonna say, Kevin, I'll put this on as my first motion to amend the budget, although maybe I'd make it $99. So, or, what is it?
$999.
No. I we pay for travel and training for work-related items for all the rest of our employees, so this should be in there. I'm serious. If you'd put this on the list. Thanks, Kevin.
Well,
this may be a question for Joe or Kevin, but where do contracts for legal services show up in our budget, because I wasn't finding them.
Where they show up in the budget, I'm not entirely sure. Many of them are made through and paid out of the risk management fund.
Okay.
So they're probably reflected in the budget in that way.
So, for example, we recently were hiring an attorney over an employment issue. Would that come out of, say, administration, or?
That specific one is coming out of the risk management pool.
Out of risk management.
Yeah, so most of them have come out of the risk management funds, unless they're for something unique or different.
I see. Okay, thank you.
I just wanted to comment to Dooley's comment. I'm an attorney, and I pay for my own CLE credits, but I'm in private practice. John is hired as an attorney for the county, and I think his credit should be paid for by the county as a condition of his employment.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. We'll stop with that. Thank you, Jonathan. Cooperative extension.
We're taking a break. That's not a good joke.
Okay. Good evening. Thanks so much for having me here. It was an incredible day. It was hard to come in. I'm sure it was even harder for you. But, hey, it's nighttime now. We don't care. So I just thought I would start with a brief sort of reminder that cooperative extension, you know, New York State has its county law, and within the county law it sets up cooperative extension as basically a tool for the county to do what the county, the Board of Supervisors or the county legislature would actually deem proper. So it's useful or it can be useful, or I would hope you would think it was useful to think about the cooperative extension as a set of tools in your county government toolbox. The recommended budget for this year includes, it's a 3.67% change. That's all one-time money that's in there for the increase. What do we do with that money? First of all, we take it, and I put this in here a little bit because in some of the other discussions there have been some questions for organizations that don't get all of their funding from the county. So in our case, that sort of orangish-yellowish from 12 to 1 would be the slice of pie that the county provides to cooperative extension in the form of an appropriation. New York State then matches, and actually more than matches, they through a formula, they give us about three times as much as, so the county puts in a quarter or puts in some money and the state gives us about between three and four dollars per dollar that the county gives us. And that number goes up. As the county number goes up, the percentage goes up, so it actually increases more quickly. So the more you give us, the more the state gives us. Federal's tiny and getting smaller every year. The grants and contracts is the blue one there. Fee for service has been growing, but the fee for service and private contributions is now totaling around $1 million a year, and the total there is about $7 million. So the county gives us roughly $700,000, and we like the proverbial, whatever that is, the story where the person goes out and raises, doesn't put it under a bushel basket, but does something else with it, increases it significantly. We take that money then, and you know a lot of work we do with youth development and parenting and so on and so forth. But I thought it'd be useful to highlight a couple of the things that we're not always known for. One of which is the contribution to county civic life. The staff themselves participate or chair over 100 boards or committees in the county throughout the county. We provide opportunities for 1,800 volunteers, and we train many of them. Those volunteers, in turn, then contribute over 55,000 hours in service of the public good. We provide training and support to over 250 natural leaders now. That program's been going on for about 9 years, and then also many other community leaders, including a lot of elected officials. We also have infrastructure, among which we provide space for meetings, for nonprofits and community-based organizations for free, and over 3,000 meetings were held last year with 36,000 people in attendance. In our role in the county economy, of course, we're known for agriculture. I was listening to TCAD's presentation, to Mike Stamp's presentation, and he cited Rosie and Ithaca Hummus. Well, in fact, Ithaca Hummus got their start in one of our kitchens, and Rosie, we've been working with them on an app for actually in conjunction with SNAP benefits. The idea is that in rural areas, if Rosie can deliver for $5, that's cheaper than people having to drive to a grocery store if they're in a food desert. That Rosie could deliver and get and collect SNAP benefit money, so people could order their groceries online, get quality groceries, pay for them with SNAP benefits, and have Rosie deliver them for cheaper than they'd have to drive to get them themselves. In the area of energy, where of course we've been doing a lot of work with market development and education to consumers. And a third area that we work in with, besides the market development and education to consumers, has been about sort of helping to sell the value and the economic potential of these areas. So for us, it's a success when the economic development agencies in the county and people who work in economic development actually spend a significant amount of their time focused on these areas. So TCAD is now involved in food and agriculture in some really interesting ways. We're in support of them in doing that. In the case of energy, again, TCAD and others are doing a lot of work in energy now. So from our view, it's a success. 10, 12 years ago, we started work in energy thinking about it as something that had enormous economic potential. Now we can get out of the way. There are economic development people who are interested in it, and they'll make it happen.
The third area, forestry and non-agricultural land use, is one that we've done some studies, we've done some work, we haven't put a lot of effort into it in the past. It's been something we've wanted to do. We did a survey of 600 landowners 10 years ago, I think it was, and there was a lot of interest on the part of landowners in doing something with their land. They don't know what. We've got something exciting, which I'll just share in a few minutes, that should help us move towards doing more work with that particular area. Work, another part of the economy is workforce and employment. And again, those hundreds of volunteers who get training, they use that training for their own businesses. In some cases, people start businesses. It helps at their work. We also have 300. We're a fairly reasonably sized employer in our own right with 330 people on payroll and $5 million payroll. And we, for some of that, we hire teenagers and people under 25. We also, in addition, we have 60 students who interned with us in 2015. I did take a slide out that had a picture of Miss New York, who actually works for us. You know, the mayor, Savante Myrick, used to work for us. I mean, there's a lot of people. There's actually several people in the city government and a number of other people in town who interned with us, and then they've stayed here. And that's been part of our strategy, is to have people, if they, while they're in college, if they intern with us or if they intern in the county, records show that they, data shows that they will stay or they will come back when they're ready to come back and settle down. Don't take it out? Okay. I thought it might be pandering a little bit. But anyway, all that will be captured, and the impact table for 2015 is here. I was going to bring it this evening, but I had to go and pick up my daughter. So it's my daughter's fault. You can blame her. The table will be ready. It'll be in your packets tomorrow, the impact table. With this table, for those who aren't familiar with it, it basically itemizes the programs that we have, program categories that we have, and talks about them in terms of the economic impact and the other types of value that it provides to the county. Some highlights from this year: 83,000 participants, 1,800 volunteers again, 60 student interns, of interest to you, $467,000 in savings and added revenue to the county budget, which means then that our net cost, or your net cost for us, is $235,000.
That's okay.
So, I just thought it would also be useful to sort of recapture from years past. When I started in 2003, we had a budget of $1.6 million, and we had about 20. We counted up that year. That was the year that the county, had told, it was a really bad year for taxes. The county had told us that we would either have a 50% cut or a 100% cut, and wanted to know what it would be, what we would do in either case. We actually decided that we were going to try not to get any cut. But so we counted up the number of people we were working with, and I know everybody was surprised at the number, including the staff. But we went through and literally combed through our data and came up with the number, and it was 24,000 in 2003, and we were all astonished at that number. This past year it was 83,000, and the budget is up. As I said, it's gone up to 6.6 million in 2015, and the county appropriations staying roughly the same, about a 15% increase. Over those years, too, we focused a lot on efficiency of operations in terms of thinking about being a steward. And I think it's interesting to look at the cost per FTE of program staff. That's dropped from 17,000, which was a reasonably decent deal back in 2003. It's now at $8,100 a piece for a full-time equivalent for program staff. Our admin ratio, our program staff to admin ratio has doubled over that time. And we thought we were doing pretty well. We were very proud to report that our leveraging at the time, for every dollar that the county was giving us, we were bringing in $3.3, and it's up to $9 now. So our 2016 highlights. The first is reference to that point I made about the non-agricultural land. And land use in general. We've been able to lease the Arnott Forest Field facility, which is it's owned by Cornell. They were going to close it up, and basically they were, we first heard about it because those cabins there on the right, they were going to dismantle them. They wanted to know if anybody wanted those and wanted to take, you know, could rebuild those cabins somewhere else. So we negotiated with them. It took a long time, didn't it, Dave? but we did succeed finally. We have a 10-year lease with an option to renew for 10 years for $1 a year. And on top of that, the Cornell gave us $60,000 to fix up, to do some improvements on it, and then we'll keep it for that for the next, for hopefully for 20 years. What are we going to do with it? We can pay for it through overnight camps and this the second bullet there. there are maintenance costs. Right. We piloted an overnight camp this summer, it was very successful. It looks like we can pay for the overall maintenance costs on an annual basis through the overnight camp. We're also offering a school for people who want to start programs like Primitive Pursuits, so forest-based environments or ecological camps. And so this school is basically a 10-month program. It's offered at the Arnott. People will stay there throughout the winter. They started in September. We needed 9 to make it break even. We have, I think, 11 there this year. So it's the only school in the Northeast. There are only 3 in the country, and this is the first one in the Northeast. 11 students. So it's people come in from all over the country, actually, and actually I think we have somebody internationally. They'll stay. It's the class itself is 3 or 4 days a week, so they can actually leave and go work if they are working somewhere else. But some people are staying year round. The other two, the forest management, agroforestry, permaculture, forest products, and then the ecotourism training opportunities, these are all areas that were indicated by the survey that we did, I said, 10 years ago. There's a lot of interest. But, in fact, if any of you know of people with interest in this or if you yourselves do, this is the area that we'll be putting some effort into over the next several years. And just for context, in the southern tier, there are 3 million acres of forest land, most of which is poorly managed. The Arnott Forest Field Facility sits on 4,000 acres of managed forest land, and it represents an enormous opportunity for training, actually, town officials, because, you know, the town laws are the ones that actually have impact on forest management in their towns. And so a big part of what we're intending to do is to focus on trainings for town supervisors and town legislators as a way of developing forest use policies that will result in significant economic growth in the region. Other highlights for 2016, the National Science Foundation, some of you may know that it was just announced a couple of weeks ago, awarded $3 million to Cornell and some partners, Solar City, BMW, and us, to work with the Energy Smart Communities Project, the NYSA work. It's really going to significantly improve what it is that's going to happen with that particular project. And then the Energy Warriors, which is a training program it's an introductory training program for kids in detention facilities to teach them about renewable energy and energy efficiency, and then connect them with job opportunities when they return to their home communities. The Office for Children and Family Services picked this up and is now in 4 sites with the intention to expand it beyond there. And other initiatives that we've been involved with, I mentioned the Energy Smart Communities. In addition to the NSF grant, we're actually involved with NYSEG on that Energy Smart Communities, focusing on the community engagement part. So they'll be hopefully working to change the culture within NYSEG to focus on how really to trust communities to have input on their, on what they're doing. Obviously we were involved with the Energy and Economic Development Task Force. I mentioned TCAD's food incubator study. We were involved with that, and some of you know that we're involved with reentry and jail issues now. Other things that we did in 2016 that I think are useful to note, the statewide website that we helped, that we basically started for cooperative extension. It's a, basically what it does is it allows every individual association to have its own website, but the data that there are the content that's put on that website is stored in a library, and other associations can pull from that and quickly build their own sites. And we share the same platform, so the development costs, all the costs for managing and maintaining the website are centralized. We now have 47 associations, and that's now finally going into the black. We advanced the money. It's now returning, and we're now getting something back for that. We did an archives grant thanks to the county, with the county clerk gave us a lot of support in ideas for what we could do with a New York State Archives grant. That we did, we're planning to expand that region-wide in 2017. We put together an RFP with to get audits, since we all have to do audits, different associations, and we use the same software, and we manage our books more or less the same. Our association took the lead and did an RFP with a firm. It's actually turned out to be a Tompkins County firm that's doing this for 14 associations across the state. We're all saving $2,000 a year. That contract's worth, you know, over $100,000. That's all coming back into Tompkins County to that firm. And then MyCCE, which you have supported in the past, that's now it started with a regional expansion in 2016, and there are more regions in the state that want to take that on. So. We also were working with the Cradle to Career, which is has this vision, you know, that basically every kid in the county will have the opportunity to achieve his or her potential. Physically, emotionally healthy and active community members, they're on track for living wage employment, they're either for college. That group, which is essentially made up of every youth development organization in the county, we're starting to move in with the business sector, the chambers on board. Basically, it's a fairly broad representation from all sectors, and these are the accomplishments from that particular effort. Our plans for 2017 are those, not much different. I do want to call out the HR database and website, which will be a complement to my CCE. It's actually incredibly exciting, and in fact, I was thinking with when Amy was talking about her training for youth development workers, essentially what it allows you to do, what we'll be able to do when this is finished, is it lays out what competencies you would need for any particular position description you have, so whatever position people fill, and then it lines up for them resources, whether they're online resources or trainings that are currently available to them, or books that they could read. Just a number of ways for people to access the resources to do their training. It'll keep a log for them. It'll basically track their records of what they've actually done in terms of staff development. And so it'll also allow us to identify staff who actually have things to offer to other staff. So it becomes a sort of a marketplace, too, within the staff themselves to trade and share their own expertise. And we are also, we've begun work on local food and commercial kitchen online directories, which will be for the county first, but they're expected to go region-wide. We're talking now about one of them going statewide. Major influences, we've reached the tipping point on reduction in administrative support. We doubled our program staff to admin staff ratios. Our whole philosophy has been, let's push it as far as we can go. When it starts to break, let's pull back. And it's starting to break. I think that's been compounded by the reduction in the number of senior program staff from 5 to 4. We talked last year about a reorganization. It's been going reasonably well, but one of the things that is problematic is that the senior program staff do admin work. When you go from 5 to 4, you've essentially reduced some of the admin that gets done by those senior staff. Another influence, we keep getting more stuff. I know you aren't familiar with this at all. We keep getting more stuff pushed down to us from the state. So if you need any more details on that, I'll be happy to share them. And I did actually, after I sent this to Kevin, I remember that obviously the FLSA is a major influence for us, and we're facing some of those same issues. In fact, I think I don't know if other groups are doing this, but we're planning on banking. We're planning on having a sort of an overtime bank, so we'll know that we're expecting some people to go into overtime. We also will probably have to reduce the number of overnights that we do for kids. We've done a lot of work in terms of investigating what we can do, what we can't do. One of the key things, and our biggest concern, frankly, is the potential change in culture. I mean, I'm very happy. I think it's really important that we do this, and I think there's some benefits that we just haven't seen, we haven't thought of yet. But one of the concerns that we can see is the change in the culture. We have a culture in our organization of people putting in tremendous numbers of hours because they love their work and they feel obligated to the participants they're working with. And we have to tell them that they can't. So, and it's amazing the number of things that we will have to do to make sure that staff don't, they can't claim, if they take an email, they've got to record it. If they do any work on the weekends, if they do anything, they've got to record it. And it's a huge change for staff. So our over target request supported by the recommended budget. Again, I want to just reiterate the support of this county of the Cooperative Extension Association here is tremendous. So, and it continues. These are all the OTRs that we requested were one time, or the ones that were recommended were all one time funding requests. The staff development initiative is in relation to the that software I was talking about, but also with the distributed leadership effort as well. So the reorganization that we have, or that we've started, really focuses on the fact that we have about 40 staff on our staff who would be program leaders in any other association. The level of responsibility, their capacity, their training, it means they would all be program leaders elsewhere. And we want to take advantage of that by developing a much more of a distributed leadership, and that requires training. Program assistance for youth development in the family community, or for youth development and family community development, is one of the OTRs that we have. As I said, we've reached the breaking point on reducing or increasing program to admin levels, and our intention here is to have a half-time position. Our intention is to grow it to full-time. But not through county money. So the intention would be that by the fourth year, we would not be asking for money from the county for this. But over the next 3 years, we gradually reduce the amount that we're asking from the county, and because we will be able to raise that money through increasing our grants and contracts or other ways. College and career readiness effort is the cradle to career. That's the last year of the one-time money that is a three-year allocation that was originally, I don't want to say promised, but it was that was the request initially, and this would be the last year for that. And then every 8 years we do an ag district review. Ag District Review 2, so there's two districts. The second one is in this coming year will be the second year of that review process. The county gave us $2,500 last year to start it, and the request is $2,500 this year to complete it. And then the two that were not are actually target money, and that was part of the reason that they weren't granted. First one is for the FLSA. We have four positions. So we have about 40 positions that actually will have to be reclassified, 36 of which we will make non-exempt, and then there were four that we were asking for a salary increase, which would put them over the threshold, over the $47,460 threshold, which would allow them. We're going to spend that money either way because they will end up working some overtime if they weren't made exempt or weren't maintained as exempt employees. And then the second is an increase for the Ag and Farmland Protection Plan. That used to be a separate, so back in the early 2000s, it was a separate amount, separate from our appropriation. It was $16,000, and it was $16,000 year after year after year. And the legislature decided to just put that money into our county appropriation. It's been at $16,000 since, I think it's year 2000, $16,000. So it's part of our appropriation right now. But what we've always treated it, because that was the way the county wanted it, as money to be used for the Ag and Farmland Protection Plan efforts. So the $16,000 that comes in from the county, we take it, we put it into a separate line. But that number has stayed the same over the 16 years, And there's been a tiny bit of inflation over that period. We'd like $4,000 to make that up.
I think that's it.
Yes.
I'm sure no one has any questions, so thank you very much for coming. Peter.
I had a question about the first slide you showed.
The title? No, sorry.
No, the one that said where the money comes
County
from.
Law 224.
The pie chart.
Oh, the pie chart.
That's the first slide.
That one there. I couldn't follow the colors. So half of the blue, the big blue thing is half of your money, right?
What's 40%.
And what's that?
That's grants and contracts.
That's grants and contracts. And then the big yellow?
Big yellow is New York State.
Uh-huh. And the federal is what color?
That's that little sliver between the yellow and the blue. So that's between New York State and grants and contracts.
Right. Is there a way you do a pointer toward it?
Okay. Thank you. I wondered.
Yeah, sorry.
No, please do it. Walk us through.
So, okay. So this is the county, and then New York State, which is about 2.3 million. So the county is roughly 700,000. That's about 2.3. This is about 100 or so, 120. This is 2.
What was the little sliver?
Sorry.
Federal?
That little sliver is federal, yes. And then grants and contracts is this one here, about 2.8 million. Fee for service is this purple one. And then the private contributions is this sliver here. And just for sort of scale, this comes out to almost exactly $1 million between the fee-for-service and the private contributions.
Any other questions? Carol?
Wait, I'm way back in the budget. I'm in budget book section 5, page 4. Why is your target budget going down by like about $50,000 before we get into the OTRs?
Because it was one-time money. So it really wasn't target money.
Oh, okay.
So last year there was one-time as well. So that one-time goes away. So our target money last year was around 650, I think, something like that, more or less.
Well, but the year before it was 691, and it's still going down to 652. So has there several years of one-time money?
It's been one-time money. So back in 2010, when we started to feel the impact from the recession, we had a cut in our target money of over 100,000. So we went from 703 or 704 down to 600. And so we've been, and the target has been going up at the level that the county has been putting, has been increasing county agency and county department target. So the 2% or 1.6% or whatever. And then other money that's been coming in over and above that has been from one-time money for various initiatives.
Okay, and then so your total OTRs that you're asking us for are
is about 75.
75. Well, yeah, but that weren't granted are about 12,000.
Yeah,
about 20, isn't it?
So okay, and you're asking for them. Are those all? Those are all target as opposed to one time.
About 12,000.
Yeah, the 12,000 is all target money. Yes, it's all part of the money that would show up in the levy.
And if we do that, it starts to make up a little bit of the difference of what we had cut you before. Okay, and
make up.
It doesn't make sense to do any of that as several years of one-time money because it's all. Well, the salary portion wouldn't make sense to do that way, but tell me about the Ag and Farmland Protection Plan. The plan is...
So there's a...
Ongoing administration of the plan rather than writing of a plan.
Yeah, the Ag and Farmland Protection Planning, it goes on. It's planning and implementation that goes on. So each of these Ag District reviews then results in an Ag and Farmland Protection Plan for that district. And then there is the implementation that takes place over the intervening years before the next plan is carried out. And so we staff both the planning process and the implementation of the plans that are developed.
Okay, thank you. Sorry if I made you repeat any of that before. It's the end of a long night.
Same kind of area, Ken. If in terms of the salary adjustments, what would be Plan B if we cannot find a way to do this?
That'll be a conversation with the board. We'll have to figure someplace else to squeeze something because I think we're either going to pay these people through a salary or we're going to pay overtime. I mean, I'm sure we're going to spend that same amount, whether it's through salary or through overtime. So my recommendation to the board would be that we figure out a way to pay them. If the county doesn't come up with the money, that we figure out some other way to pay for them.
Okay. And
I'm shooting myself in the foot by saying that.
But a question for Joe. I know you, this may not have made the cut, but you're thinking in terms of why you could not support that? Or?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with children. It goes back to that capacity issue. I just didn't have enough target authority to be able to cover this.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And Ken, you're typically overwhelmed us with all the things that you're doing, and Dave and I have the pleasure of sitting on the board. We are somewhat much more familiar, but even I was learning things tonight. What you didn't even mention, of course, is a whole big project to basically improve your core facility and make some additions. I hope at some point you'll come back and bring this body up to date on that because it's very, very exciting.
I kind of want to raise a little bit of money first. Right now it looks great on paper, but, until we have it. Yeah, but yes.
Lovely.
Ken, this is a follow-up to the salary adjustments. So are the people there part-time and you're trying to bring them full-time?
No.
So I don't understand the comparison with overtime then.
Well, so right now, if we So there, if we don't raise those people, right now they're making roughly, let's just say that they're making $45,000. Mm-hmm. They have to make 47.4. So if we didn't increase their salary by $2,400, they would have to be classified as non-exempt employees. They would have to go to hourly.
Thank you.
When they do that, then they would charge overtime.
Thank you. Master, you just don't like drunken kids.
That's right. We're done.